You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Flashpoints.
This is Guns and Butter.
Something happening here. Yeah, yeah. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
Yeah, that's right.
Telling me I've got to beware. It's time we stop, children. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today on Guns and Butter, Michelle Chosadovsky. Today's show, Political Crisis in the United States. Michelle Chosadovsky is an economist and the founder, director, and editor of the Center for Research on Globalization, based in Montreal, Quebec. He is the author of 11 books, including The Globalization of Poverty and the New World Order, War and Globalization, The Truth Behind September 11th, America's War on Terrorism, and The Globalization of War, America's Long War Against Humanity. Michelle Chosadovsky, welcome.
Delighted to be on the program.
Michelle, in your article that has just come out, Hillary Clinton, Wall Street's losing horse, constitutional crisis, what's the end game? You refer to the second letter sent by FBI Director James Comey to the U.S. Congress. What is the second letter as opposed to the first letter?
Well, this story is evolving by the minute. When I started investigating this over the weekend, I looked at the preamble to this event, and I think this is absolutely crucial. On the 24th of October, in other words, 4 days before the release of the second letter, there was a revelation in the Wall Street Journal, which I think is fundamental, pointing to bribery, fraud, and corruption within the FBI, triggered by a approximately 500,000 donation to the wife of a senior official in the FBI for her election campaign in Virginia. Now, this money was sent through the governor of Virginia. It was never acknowledged in the official records of donations for her campaign. From my point of view, it was a payout. But it was a payout not only to her, but to her husband, who is a senior member of the FBI. I'm talking about Dr. Jill McCabe, who was the candidate, and she is the wife of FBI official Andrew McCabe. Now, what happened is that Andrew McCabe, a few months after the election, which she lost, incidentally, she didn't get her seat, a few months later, in January of this year, 2016, Andrew McCabe was appointed deputy director of the FBI, in other words, number two man, and he was put in charge of the Clinton email investigation. How convenient. It's very similar to, you know, the mafia boss in the 1930s. We see it on Hollywood buying up the police, okay? You give them a bribe of $500,000, then you put them in charge of an investigation on organized crime, and their function essentially is to stall that investigation. Now, that works as long as the information is not made public regarding this corruption within the FBI. In other words, number two man Andrew McCabe is corrupt. There are pressures from within the FBI directed against the director, James Comey. And I assume that James Comey also wants to ensure his authority and quote-unquote integrity. So ultimately, that is one of the elements. There are other complex elements with regarding the emails. But that's one of the elements which I think triggered James Comey's second letter. Because, for one thing, I don't think he wanted to be entirely complicit with this bribery of the $500,000, which was paid to his colleague, number two man, and so on and so forth. But what is very important is that Hillary gave $500,000 to a senior police officer in the FBI in exchange for favors regarding the Clinton investigation, which was not strictly limited to the emails. It was also pertaining to the Clinton Foundation and so on and so forth. There's a whole string of criminality behind the Clinton family. So that is the background. But I'll explain a little bit the second stage subsequently.
Michelle, hundreds of thousands of dollars were donated to Jill McCabe's campaign for state senate in Virginia, as you've just stated. She is the wife of Andrew McCabe, who was soon to be appointed FBI deputy director in charge of the Clinton email investigation, which you've just talked about. This huge donation was from, and this is according to the Wall Street Journal article that you cited of August 24th, this huge donation was from Virginia Governor Terry McAuliffe. Now, who is Terry McAuliffe, and how do we know that this money was from Clinton? I'm assuming that these claims were made in the Wall Street Journal article.
Precisely. First of all, it was October 24th. Now, the claims were made in effect in the Wall Street Journal, which used the term Clinton ally aided campaign of FBI official's wife. Okay, that was the headline. Group linked to Virginia Governor Terry McAuliffe donated nearly $500,000 to 2015 state senate candidate. Now, that whatever they're supporting her election campaign. No, they're not, because she's married to if the FBI official had stayed quiet at the lower ranks, but he didn't. He became number two man, and then he was entrusted with investigation into the Clinton wrongdoings. So he's obviously in conflict of interest. This is standard procedure in the police. We know it from, all we have to do is to go and look at a Hollywood movie. It happens in every second movie. You're buying out the police. But this is a different. This is not organized crime as we, categorize it, buying out the police, bribing the police. It is a former Secretary of State and a candidate to the highest position in the land, namely President of the United States, which is bribing an official in the FBI. That is the crucial issue. Now, ironically, the media has not looked into it. They haven't followed up on that. They followed up on the email scandal, which is also, the email scandal is also pretty bad. It's the Huma Abedin emails, etc., have a whole dirty history behind that, okay, with pedophilia and so on. I don't want to get into that, but there are several authors which have examined it in detail. But the fact of the matter is that when James Comey decided to release this, I'm sure he knew everything beforehand, okay, and he may. Whether he's a good clean cop, a good cop or a bad cop, we can't establish that at this moment. But he certainly went against his colleague, Andrew McCabe, who was in charge of the investigation in launching this second letter. And the second letter is damning. It opens up a Pandora's box because there's not simply the emails. There's a lot of other stuff, very, very serious, including what I would describe as acts of treason. Why? Because Hillary Clinton's, well, the Clinton Foundation is funded by Saudi Arabia and Qatar, generous foundations, and it just so happens that Saudi Arabia and Qatar are financing the Islamic State, which is also, from the point of view of Hillary Clinton, is the enemy of the United States of America. They're waging a war on terrorism, and she was Secretary of State at the time. So, you know, that's an act of treason, okay? It's an act of treason to receive donations from the state sponsors of terrorism. But if we can get back to the chronology of what happened, I think it's very important. And then we have to ask ourselves, what is the role of WikiLeaks? I personally don't think that WikiLeaks are some hackers. The people behind WikiLeaks is the intelligence community. And I think that's pretty much known. They may be intelligence officials who are going against the stream, but there are very significant divisions within the what we call the elites, the financial establishment, and there's also divisions within the media. And in effect, this trigger mechanism of the Wall Street Journal would not have happened if those divisions hadn't occurred. Because whereas Warner, you know, Times, Warner, CNN are just churning out smear after smear directed against Trump with very, very biased coverage of the election campaign, the Wall Street Journal, Fox News, and a couple of other media, they're not the majority by any means, they are, in fact, reporting on the misdemeanors of the Clinton campaign. And to address that, we have to understand that the man behind News Corp, which owns the Wall Street Journal and owns Fox News, is Rupert Murdoch, okay? The multi-billionaire, Australian of Australian origin, which controls a large share of the world's news media, not only in North America, but, I mean, worldwide. I can say, and I've looked into it carefully, Richard Murdoch is a strong supporter, or has become a strong supporter, of Donald Trump. They wined and dined in Scotland in the month of June. They've been meeting several times. And I suspect that this release by the Wall Street Journal pointing to bribery and corruption at the highest ranks of the Federal Bureau of of the FBI, that is something which was carefully timed to occur 11 days before the election. But it's not so much the that report ultimately, in effect, was a signal to James Comey. The issue of corruption is public. People in the FBI knew about it at all levels, and there was also pressure on the director to come clean, so to speak, and because his number two man, who was responsible for the for the investigation of Clinton and the emails and so on, Andrew McCabe, not only did he cash in on $500,000, at least his wife did, they didn't spend it on the election. I don't think so. I looked at the records of his wife's donation. First of all, they didn't declare it, which is illegal, okay? They didn't declare that money. So it was handed to them in some way. So that is the object of an investigation. But, of course, look, James Comey knew about all this before the Wall Street Journal came out. But what the Wall Street Journal article did is it made it brought to the public the fact that there was corruption and there was bribery, and that Hillary Clinton, in the same way as the mafia bosses Al Capone et al. Do, they buy up the police, and she did it through the governor of Virginia, who is a friend and a crony. That's what happened. And then we have to ask ourselves, who is behind this? And I think to say that it's simply Rupert Murdoch is a bit simplified. Certainly, he authorized this to take place. He had people writing in the Wall Street Journal, which on the whole have been critical of Hillary and her various and her record of criminality and so on, the Democratic National Committee and so on and so forth. But I think he understood very well that given the pressures that they had talked about, pressures within the FBI, it was really conflict between him and his number two man. And now his number two man is he received the money, his wife, they must have a joint bank account. They received the money, but he's still sitting there. He hasn't been dismissed or investigated in any way. He's clean. He is clean. Why? Because he's being protected maybe by Attorney General Loretta Lynch, Clinton and so Clinton and even the Obama administration. So he's clean, okay? FBI Director James Comey is now threatened with legal action. They say that he broke the law. That's very far-fetched. And Andrew McCabe, who cashed in on the money, he's protected by the mafia boss. It's a very sort of typical, you could practically write a Hollywood script on this whole thing. Okay?
I'm speaking with economist and director of the Center for Research on Globalization, Michel Chosadovsky. Today's show, Political Crisis in the United States. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. Well, Michel, you have mentioned that the media in general is not really dealing with the information you've been describing that was published in the Wall Street Journal on October 24th. You've also pointed out that CNN, Time Warner, they are nonstop running ads or commentary against Trump. And then we have Fox, owned by Rupert Murdoch, Fox, Mail Online, etc. Also, maybe the New York Post also. The New York Post has printed a scathing remarks about Hillary Clinton. So there is this division that you've described within the media conglomerates, and then the people or the forces behind these two media conglomerates are obviously at loggerheads. Now, you have mentioned to me that the elites are not monolithic, that basically they all of them want to make money. How do you see the division here? I have always viewed Hillary Clinton's candidacy as the war candidate, basically. She's called for a no-fly zone over Syria. She has said that she wants a Syrian President Assad deposed. She is making negative remarks about Putin nonstop, accusations about the Russians hacking her email, etc. To my mind, clearly, she would be the candidate that would continue the 9/11 wars. On the other hand, then you have Donald Trump, making statements in the debate like, "Well, why can't we get along with Russia?" Do you have an opinion as to what is going on here in terms of the conflicts among the powers that be behind these candidates? Now, obviously, there's the financial community, there's the military-industrial complex, there's the media conglomerates. How do you view this breakdown? Let's say, are the elites no longer supporting Hillary Clinton?
Well, I think it's pretty complex. I think that Hillary Clinton is really the proxy for. I mean, the proxy president. She's a puppet for what we describe as the neocons. Okay, the neocons is a power elite. It's on Wall Street. It's the military industrial complex. It's the oil companies. It also has a long-term military agenda, which was defined in the project for the New American Century. It's continuity in relation to George W. Bush and of course, Obama. Mind you, that sort of neoconservative consensus is quite widespread because, Kerry also is in the same bag, okay? He's also calling for a no-fly zone and this, that, and other. So we're not – what we have is, I think, a clique – both in terms of foreign policy stance of maybe the think tanks, Council on Foreign Relations, Project for the New American Century, and so on and so forth, which now are pushing forward this notion of confrontation with Russia, including a World War III. Okay? They even say that. They have a new doctrine on nuclear weapons, which was formulated back in 2001, 2002, of preemptive nuclear war. They have actually cleared tactical nuclear weapons, the small mini-nukes, but which have an explosive capacity between one-third and 12 times a Hiroshima bomb, the so-called B-61-11 and the new version B-61-12. As harmless to the surrounding civilian population because the explosion is underground, quote-unquote, scientific opinion on contract to the Pentagon. And Hillary, in her campaign, says, yes, nuclear weapons on the table. And with regard to Iran, she even says, and she quote, and I quote her, we will obliterate them, quote-unquote. Now, I think, first of all, that perspective of hers, of actually igniting and having and believing somehow that they can win World War III, because World War III will not be won by anybody. It's terminal for humanity. And we've just published an article on nuclear winter. There are 15,000 nuclear weapons in the world, and Hillary wants to use them. Now, inevitably, within the establishment, there are people, they are interest groups. Some of them don't care. They just want to make money. But there's not much money to be made out of a terminal World War III scenario. So there is a lot of dissent within powerful interest groups against this agenda, including the armed forces. And the Joint Chiefs of Staff... the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff just a month ago informed the Senate Armed Services Committee as well as Secretary of State John Kerry that a no-fly zone over Syria would lead to war with Russia and that he did not contemplate that as a wise decision. So there's a lot of dissent within the armed forces. And there's a dissent within the intelligence community. There are people in the legal profession. We're not talking about, you know, the activists and the hackers. We're talking about people who have been running, who are career within the system. Now, there's a very interesting sideline to that, and I've just recently published it. It has to do with a former Undersecretary of State. His name is Steve Piezenik is a Polish name. He was Deputy Assistant Secretary of State in several U.S. administrations, including Gerald Ford, Jimmy Carter, Ronald Reagan, and George W. Bush. And he has just recently released a video. He has a blog site, and he provides an analysis and focus, which I think should be taken very seriously. It sheds light on the fact that the political crisis in the U.S. and the opposition, which is developing from within, is from the intelligence community. And he is a former intelligence official. And what he's saying is essentially that the Clintons, but broadly speaking, is more than that. It's the entourage and the groups that support them, including the weapons producers, that Clinton is planning a coup, which is leading to the demise. Well, in effect, is leading to what I describe as the criminalization of the state apparatus, of the judicial system, okay, of law enforcement, because then you have an attorney general who is being threatened or bribed or whatever, and then you have a guy in the FBI at a very senior level who is being bought out with $500,000, and he has made a statement to that effect. And he's also intimated, of course, that WikiLeaks is really originates from U.S. intelligence. Okay, I've always believed that WikiLeaks, which sends us so much information, which has now become sort of authoritative, is from it's from within the system. It's not some activist hacking and getting hold of the emails. It must be a very organized process. So we have to ask ourselves, who is behind WikiLeaks, which releases this email and reveals the criminality of senior officials in high office? I beg the question: who is behind FBI Director James Comey? I think that James Comey is ultimately responding to a situation of crisis, and he's trying to cover. I think people do use that expression, and there he has a number two man, Andrew McCabe, who essentially is Hillary's Trojan horse within the FBI, and who's taking instructions. At least he's conducting his investigation in a way which is not going to damage her. But then you have, you asked me, are the elites divided? Well, historically, they've always been divided. There's always been conflict, and those conflicts have led to wars. They've led to recessions, speculative onslaughts, manipulation inside the banks that are at each other's throats. And maybe they stick together, and then they go after the Italian banks, okay? But there's constantly a conflict and division within the establishment. Now, what was revealing last night, I started sort of switching back and forth between CNN on the one hand and Fox News on the other. The discourse was so incredibly different. And then Fox News, the Hannity show, which is not my favorite show by any means, okay, they once invited me, and I turned them down because I thought they were going to – well, they did intend, actually, to smear me. But actually, Hannity was really good. He interviewed Giuliani. And Giuliani, former mayor of New York – comes out, and he doesn't necessarily say I'm in favor of Trump. He says Hillary Clinton is involved in a criminal undertaking, which nobody can support. Okay, And I mean, she was senator for the state of New York, and he was mayor of New York. They know each other. Maybe they hate each other, but the thing is that you have prominent people who are now, they're not necessarily siding with Trump. They're siding against Clinton, you see? Well, they may be siding with Trump. Trump, from my standpoint, well, I'm in Canada, so I'm not going to vote, unless, of course, the United States decides to annex Canada. But Trump is not a dangerous candidate from the foreign policy perspective, because at least his narrative, what he will do, that's another matter, but his narrative is not saying we must go and kill Assad and wage war on Russia and move our troops to the Russian border and start bombing them with nuclear weapons. That's what Hillary Clinton is intimating. So that, in effect, I think that Trump, despite all his personal features and so on, is, they're not comparable, but he's not as dangerous as Clinton. Clinton could unleash World War III. And I, one has to address how a World War III is actually decided upon, apart from the fact that sometimes it's error, misjudgment, paranoia, whatever. But it's pressing on a button. And the pressing on a button to wage, let's say, a nuclear attack doesn't necessarily come from one person. It's the result of consultations with advisors, the military, this, that, and other debate, discussion, do we do it, don't we do it? But ultimately, the President of the United States can say, no, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to press the button and initiate a third world conflict. And she will not hesitate one moment. And if she had to make that decision, she'll make it. I've looked at all her statements. She's a very dangerous person.
I'm speaking with economist and director of the Center for Research on Globalization, Michel Chosadovsky. Today's show, Political Crisis in the United States. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. Michel, you have said to me that whoever ascends to the presidency of the United States, that whoever the next president is, the presidency will be a dysfunctional one. Could you describe how the new president or the new presidency of the United States is going to be dysfunctional? In what ways? What could happen, whether it's Clinton or Trump? And then I'm wondering, how dangerous is a dysfunctional presidency? Is it safer, like maybe things won't get done? Or would it lead to maybe a leap forward into war? What about why do you say that the next presidency will be a dysfunctional one?
Okay. Well, first of all, if Hillary is elected, let's assume she's elected, Hillary's criminal record, which is there, and the investigation is ongoing, and it is very extensive. It's not just emails. It's the foundation. It's targeted assassinations. It goes back to her days in Arkansas. Her criminal record will haunt her throughout her term in office. I have absolutely no doubt about that, leading to the possibility of an impeachment. But even if it's not an impeachment, the public will know about it, okay? The public will know about it. I once said to myself, well, you really need a criminal record to get to be appointed as candidate to the United States presidency, okay? You need to be, because criminals are people you can manipulate, so they're good puppets. But I think that in the case of Hillary Clinton, you know, her record is so extensive that it will be very difficult to hide. So there's that element. It will haunt her throughout her presidency. But inevitably, Trump will launch a procedure claiming fraud, because I think there's going to be fraud. Okay, we've done a fair amount of research on the voting machines and so on, and there was fraud in previous elections. But in this particular case, you have a, you know, you have a person, whether we like him or not, he's pop. Well, he has a certain element of grassroots support. And if Hillary wins the election by a small margin, we can be sure that he will launch a procedure against her and against the vote and so on and so forth. So we're dealing with two, if we periodize what's going to happen, we've got three periods. We've got from now, November 2nd to November 8th, okay, when the results come in. That doesn't leave much time, but things can happen within those 6 days in terms of more information coming out, which will influence the voters either way, okay? Secondly, we have the period between the 8th of November the aftermath of the election until the transfer of the position of presidency, which is in the month of January, okay? So that's it's about a month. Lots of things can happen within that period, particularly in relation to irregularities, and of course the criminal record of Hillary Clinton is still there. People across the United States, and there was a poll just conducted a few days ago, people don't believe the media anymore. The recent poll believes that 75% of people participating in this sample, in this sample poll, they believe that the media is lying to them when they say that when Russia is intervening in the elections or in the Democratic National Committee and so on and so forth. They don't buy that anymore. They know that the media is lying to them. And I think that we're in a situation where mass protests could very well unfold. But let's say if Hillary comes in, Trump will launch one or more procedures pertaining to fraud at different stages of the election campaign, voting machines, etc., criminality, the FBI will continue, okay, with investigation. Those records are there. They can't be wiped out. And I'm sure that immediately after the election, if she is elected, Trump will renew his campaign against her on corruption, large scale, et cetera, et cetera. And attempt to block any kind of her accession to the White House. Now, she's dysfunctional, but so is Trump dysfunctional. So if Trump is elected president, there will also be attempts to unseat him, right? Calling for his impeachment. The other side's going to do it because they're very powerful. They've got the nail cons behind them and so on. They're going to do something to destabilize Trump. And it may be actually what I'd call Plan B or Plan C, which posits that if both candidates are dysfunctional, we might be moving, not necessarily immediately after the elections, but at some point in the future, we might be moving towards a situation of martial law. Okay, it's not an impossibility. Okay, the unfolding political impasse, coupled with rising geopolitical tensions in Syria, Iraq, Eastern Europe, on Russia's border, the possibility of a World War III, it could potentially lead at some future date to the suspension of constitutional government under what is described as the... There are many pieces of legislation to choose from, but the most significant and the one which is least known by the American public, because the media have simply not discussed it and debated, is the National Defense Authorization Act, NDAA, H.R. 1540, which was signed into law by President Obama on December 31, 2011. And then it's a, but there are other pieces of legislation which have been adopted both before and after 9/11, which allow for this transition to police state America, namely the repeal of civil liberties, the surveillance state, the militarization of law enforcement, and so on. And that, of course, that is also geared towards the broader public who might protest to having Hillary Clinton as president of the United States. I certainly would protest. And also the fact that these rising political and social tensions are the result of years and years of austerity measures, closing down of jobs, offshoring, and so on and so forth, mass poverty in throughout the land, and this eventually will, I think, backlash. It's the consequence of a macroeconomic agenda, the so-called not the neocon but the neoliberal macroeconomic agenda, which has devastated national economies since the 1980s, but which is also now applied in the United States of America and in Western Europe, and we saw what happened in Greece. So, you know, if you look at dysfunctional presidencies, you might say, well, maybe there might be a transition towards martial law in the forthcoming years. Not, I wouldn't say necessarily immediately after the elections, but that is how it's likely to unfold. It's very difficult to predict what will be the result of this election.
I'm speaking with economist and director of the Center for Research on Globalization, Michel Chosadovsky. Today's show, Political Crisis in the United States. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. Michel, you have been describing a political crisis, and you've touched on an economic crisis here in the United States. It sounds like some sort of perfect storm is brewing on the political front, the economic front, the geopolitical front. Vladimir Putin is preparing the Russian citizens for a nuclear war. They're moving armaments, of course, into Syria. There was also, I read, he had a drill in Moscow where the millions of residents of Moscow could go underground. Putin is taking all of this war talk from the neocons and from Hillary quite seriously. And I think hopefully now people here are not thinking it's a big joke anymore. It looks like there's a perfect storm brewing, and kind of hard to say what is going to happen, right?
Well, there's no doubt the storm is brewing, and I think we're at a very dangerous crossroads in our history, and this is most probably the most serious crisis in world history, because it could lead to the end of humanity if and when a nuclear war is instigated, and I think even the vote at the UN last week was very significant. That there's a consensus that nuclear weapons have to be banned, have to be eliminated. But that's not going to happen, and it's not going to happen within the immediate short term. Now, with regard to Russia, those emergency measures, the scenario of emergency measures, was not strictly in Moscow. It was across the Russian Federation and involved something of the order of 40 million people. In other words, these were areas, underground refuge areas. I guess in Moscow it might be even in the subway system. I didn't follow the details, but it was 40 million people. Now, I mean, when you do that, it sends perceptions both to those who are planning to attack you. It also sends perceptions to the Russian people, okay, that this is serious. But at the same time, you know, there's a sort of a little bit of a game going on between the two sides. Russia is threatened by the United States with nuclear weapons. It doesn't mean necessarily that they'll do it. I don't think they'll choose Russia initially. If they're going to use nuclear weapons, it might be against Iran. Okay, and the statements have been very strong. But that will unleash a broader war inevitably. Okay, but I think that first of all, U.S. policymakers now have become increasingly aware of the fact that Russia has a very advanced military arsenal, which at the end of the Cold War they didn't have, okay, because there was a period with Yeltsin where they were actually dismantling it. And but that is not the case today. Russia has a very advanced military arsenal. It's controlled by the state, which gives them much more leeway in making it functional rather than money-making or profit-driven, which is the case of the big defense contractors. It doesn't cost them nearly as much as it costs the United States of America, so they can still allocate money to social programs and so on and so forth. But yes, we are, that kind of scenario is there. And you mentioned recently, of course, they're moving an aircraft carrier to the Middle East. It's the Kuznetsov. Okay, it's the Russia's Kuznetsov. They don't have many aircraft carriers, but they moved it to the Middle East, and immediately, and they have a naval base there. So there's nothing really particularly. It's routine. They're moving warships to the Middle East. Okay, and they're also saying, well, listen, okay, go ahead with the no-fly zone. We have our planes are there, and they can fly them in from the Caspian Sea. The distances are not very large for a jet fighter. But the thing is that when they brought in their warships into the Mediterranean, immediately NATO meets and starts deploying weapons and tanks and artillery and forces at Russia's doorstep in the Baltic states and in Poland and Romania and so on. So you can see that U.S. NATO is on a war footing. They had the last when was it? Month of June. They had these major war games, which I think were very large. It was the Anaconda. If anybody knows what the anaconda is, it's a very dangerous snake. You know, it's symbolic. It kills people.
Well, yes, Michel, you and I did a whole hour-long show on the anaconda war games that were taking place, I guess, in Eastern Europe on behalf of the United States. That's right. We called that show Global Warfare or something to that effect. Now, Michel, With regard to the scandals going on domestically here, with regard to Hillary Clinton, this whole email thing, Obama came out and sort of put the kibosh on talk about FBI Director James Comey having broken the law. I guess the Hillary camp was accusing the FBI director of having broken the law, and as you said to me, well, you know, Obama wasn't ready to back that up. One thing that has always I have not understood about this email scandal of Hillary Clinton's, what I don't understand about it is that the National Security Agency and the intelligence agencies, etc., would have known all along about her email setup. So if her email behavior was such a threat to so-called national security, then why was she allowed to do all of this?
Well, yeah, they've probably known a long time what she was doing. And there was probably very, well, I would say that within the FBI, there was people who were probably intent on protecting her. Then there may be people who weren't. But the thing is, it's not strictly, I don't think that it is strictly the emails, okay? It's much broader than that, and it has to do also with her foundation, okay? She's involved in money laundering. It's crony because the people who come make a donation to the Clinton Foundation, then they get favors when she was Secretary of State. It's not strictly one level of criminality. It's much, much more, you know, it's much more serious. We have to really reflect on that. Now, you said that that Obama didn't take such an active stance with regard to the illegality. Was it with regard to the illegality of James Comey or what?
Well, James Comey was being accused by the Hillary camp of having broken the law, coming out 11 days before the election and saying that the FBI was reopening the investigation into her emails.
Well, I mean, the thing is that James Comey did the right thing, because what she had done, as reported by the Wall Street Journal, but also in relation to the email scandals, reveals a whole network of criminality and corruption. I think he did the right thing. Now, they're accusing him of having brought this information out prior to the election, but in fact he didn't, because it's already been brought out on several occasions. There was a first letter, but there was a whole discussion of these issues going months and months back. So this is nothing new. But what is new is the fact that the corruption within the FBI is now known to everybody, at least to people who read the Wall Street Journal, because the media is not talking about it. Okay, but the thing is that there you have a guy at the upper echelons of the FBI, his number two man, Andrew McCabe, who is being bribed by the crime boss. I can use those terms. That's the mechanism. You bribe a senior police officer so that you can continue with your criminality. And you put him in charge of the investigation, and he blocks the investigation. Now, I think Comey will go down in history. He will go down in history. And bear in mind James Comey is appointed for 10 years. First of all, he was appointed by Obama, okay, 3 years ago. That's very important. Obama appointed him. And then he was, he reports to the Attorney General, and he also reports to the Director of National Intelligence, okay? Of course, his appointment is also approved by the Senate. But the thing is, you don't simply flush an FBI director, okay? I mean, in America, people remember the J. Edgar Hoover, you know, saga. You know, these people stay there for a long, long time. You don't move them. The deputy, and that's what amazes me. Well, it doesn't amaze me, but the guy who actually took the bribe of $500,000 through his wife is sitting there, and he's the hero. They, you know, they're praising him, and they're still talking to him. And when, in fact, he should have been arrested for taking a bribe, it's open, at least investigated, and suspended, and he's not. But what they want to do, they want to get rid of Comey. But I think that's not going to be easy. Under constitutional government, that's not going to be easy to get rid of Comey. And I think that Obama, I don't think that Obama wants to be overtly involved in this scam in any way possible. He's supporting Hillary because she's a Democrat and she's coming after him. I don't think we know that Hillary ran against him, previously, and then she was appointed Secretary of State. He didn't want her as Secretary of State. They imposed Hillary Clinton on him. So there's a whole very complex relations which are unfolding. When I said earlier, I guess we're running out of time, but when I said earlier that there were conflicts within, let's say, within the economic establishment, it's not because Rupert Murdoch actually sides with Trump. Rupert Murdoch is all over the place. It's a media conglomerate which has alliances with the energy companies, with various sectors of the economy.
Well, Michel, we are out of time. I'd like to thank you, Michel Chosadovsky. Thank you so much for this great live interview on Guns and Butter.
Thank you very much. I regret that we're out of time. Best wishes. And to everybody in California and in the United States, think twice. Think carefully when you vote.
Thank you, Michel. And Michel Chosadovsky's website is globalresearch.ca. You can send me, Bonnie Faulkner, an email at faulkner@gunsandbutter.org. This has been Guns and Butter. Thank you so much.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, Phyllis Bennis on the many wars in Syria, and why the only sane response is to stop fighting them and try diplomacy. I hope you'll stay tuned. Phyllis Bennis came out to Boston on the 13th of October, 2016. She gave a fine talk titled, Ending the Many Wars in Syria. The many wars now all going on at once, that is, even as we speak. Some of these are proxy wars, between Saudi Arabia and Iran, for example. But as Bennis reminds us, these wars between other countries are being fought to the last Syrian. Phyllis Bennis is a writer and activist, a staunch progressive, and she's a very fine public speaker. I really like listening to her, and I trust you will too. Bennis has a particular interest in U.S. foreign policy, especially U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East. In a recent talk on New World Notes, she described herself as a middle-class Jewish girl from California. Even so, she is known as an outspoken critic of the foreign and domestic policies of Israel, and an advocate for Palestinian rights. But today, her focus is on neither country, but a bit farther to the northeast, on Syria, which is not to say that Israel and Palestine are irrelevant to the ongoing crisis in Syria. Bennis is a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, that very good progressive think tank in Washington, D.C. She spoke at Emmanuel College in Boston on October 13. Emmanuel College is new to me. Turns out it's a small Catholic liberal arts college, and it has a student group called Emmanuel College Peace Action, who helped sponsor Bennis' visit. Hats off to them. Hats off also to Massachusetts Peace Action, which co-sponsored the talk. Which made me think, where the heck is Connecticut Peace Action? No such critter, apparently. Even Google never heard of it. We have heard of Phyllis Bennis, though, and now we'll hear the first half of Bennis's Boston talk, and the rest next week. Ending the many wars in Syria. Here is Phyllis Bennis.
Well, thanks to Emmanuel and to Emmanuel Peace Action. This is a great chance to, I haven't been to Emmanuel before, so this is a great chance to see the school. And it's, I think, an important time for folks to be coming together to talk about the war in Syria and what it's a part of, the broader war that it's one part of, because things are going from bad to worse. Things are not getting better. And left to their own devices, our government and other governments are pretty sure to do the wrong thing rather than the right thing most of the time when it comes to these wars. So I think it's an important time to be talking about it. You know, it's difficult in a certain way to talk about the war in Syria, because the war in Syria is not a war, and it's not only in Syria, but it's part of a global war. We could identify what President Bush called the global war on terror, and the war that's raging in Syria is part of that war. The other complication is that the war in Syria is not a single war. The war in Syria is about 8 or 9 or 10 separate wars divided into two sections. So there's a civil war going on between the Syrian regime and part of its population that began, as you know, in the context of the Arab Spring in with a nonviolent uprising for asking for political reforms, quickly militarized when the regime clamped down with enormous brutality, was answered with a newly militarized movement, and morphed fairly quickly into civil war. But separate from that, there's a whole host of proxy wars being waged in Syria, whether it's between Saudi Arabia and Iran, who are looking for who's going to be the regional hegemon in terms of oil and military power and economic power and political power, and in terms of a sectarian war also between Iran and Saudi Arabia, whether Sunni or Shia Islam is going to be dominant in the region. Then there's wars of other forces. There's a war between the U.S. and Israel against Iran for all kinds of things. There's a war between the religious or and many of them extremist, but not all, and the secular forces within the opposition. There's several wars between Turkey and the Kurds, and there's struggles between various Kurdish forces. All of these are being waged to the last Syrian. But most of them don't have anything to do with Syria and will not do any good for anybody in Syria. There's also a war going on that has been a Cold War up until now, but is rapidly heating up. And that's the war between the United States and Russia, which is getting worse and worse in Syria. And we're hearing very dangerous developments just in the last few days. There's the good news is that Secretary of State Kerry is trying once again to get talks underway. There's some plans for talks in Lausanne in Switzerland on Saturday. Nobody is too optimistic about those talks. And in the midst of those talks, we're also hearing about new escalations on all sides, military moves that are quite threatening when there's no talks underway and no easy way out for either of these giant superpowers overarmed with military and particularly nuclear weapons. So there's some very dangerous developments underway. And the urgency, therefore, for reaching some kind of negotiated ceasefire, arms deal, arms control, and ultimately diplomatic solution becomes more urgent than ever. So the context of all this, and I'll get into a little bit of the detail, not too much, but the context of it all is what President Bush called the global war on terror. Now, you remember, some of you, most of you are too young to remember, but you've probably read about it. After 9/11, the day after, even the day of, we heard from President Bush there was a choice, that Americans had a choice. We could either go to war or let them get away with it. It was war or nothing. And since most people didn't want to just say, let them get away with it, do nothing, a lot of people supported war who might otherwise have been against it. Why would they have been against it? Well, to start with, none of the hijackers were from Afghanistan. None were Afghans. They were mainly Saudis and a couple of Egyptians. They didn't live in Afghanistan. They lived in Hamburg. They didn't train in Afghanistan. They trained in Florida. They didn't go to flight school in Afghanistan. They went to flight school in Minnesota. So what were we doing bombing Afghanistan? Because they were inspired by somebody who was holed up in Afghanistan. But we also know that a big part of the reason for the war in Afghanistan, aside from revenge, despite the rhetoric, this was never a war for justice. This was a war for revenge. But it was also a war to prepare the political ground for a war in Iraq. Now, why? Because there were weapons of mass destruction. Oh, no, that's wrong. It's because Saddam Hussein was responsible for 9/11. Oh, no, that's not quite right. Except a lot of people in this country still think that's true, because we were told it over and over and over again by people in Washington who most people in this country like to assume knew something more than we knew, had access to more information than we knew, or some version thereof. So the global war on terror is launched. And what we see is that the U.S. has been at war with terrorism for 15 years, and terrorism is doing just fine. Terrorism is thriving. The people and the cities and the countries where this so-called war against terrorism is being waged, they're not doing so well. People are being killed. Cities are being destroyed. The levels of instability and violence and chaos have escalated throughout an enormous and expanding region. Now, to his credit, and it's about the only thing I want to give him credit for here, President Bush understood what he was doing, and he called it a global war, exactly what it was. President Obama, when he was elected on a platform of ending what he called the dumb war in Iraq and promising, as he did, to expand the smart war in Afghanistan, something he did, that was a promise kept. I think too many people sort of skipped that part when they were looking at his anti-war credentials and saying, great, he's going to end the war in Iraq, and not looking at the other side of it. But on the second day after he came into office, the Obama administration sent out a memo to the White House and to the Pentagon and to the State Department, to, you know, pretty much everybody, saying, we would rather that you not call this the global war on terror. We would rather use the term overseas contingency operation. Now, it's pretty Orwellian. You know, it's this anodyne description, overseas operation. It's kind of, you know, the global fire truck getting the kitten out of the tree. When I heard it, I thought, well, that's what you do, like if you send the Navy to rescue people off the coast of Haiti who have been displaced from the hurricane. That's an overseas operation, right? This is a war, and he should call it a war. Now, it's not the same kind of war. It's quite different. It doesn't involve hundreds of thousands of ground troops, as George Bush's war did. But there is no question this is a war. Just ask anybody in Afghanistan or Iraq or Syria or Yemen or Djibouti or Somalia or Libya or any of these countries where these wars are being waged. So what we have is the continuation of a global war on terror, but one that is not identified as a full-scale war, despite the costs to the people and cities and countries where it's being waged, and ultimately the costs here at home in the discrediting of our government and our policies, in the financial costs, which I'll get to later. But we're seeing all of this at a moment when the U.S. is expanding militarism around the world. It isn't only in the war theater of the broader Middle East. It's also the militarization of foreign policy, where extreme sanctions that are crippling for ordinary people and military threats and the escalation of military capacities around the world take the place of a diplomatic focus for diplomacy, for foreign policy. So the irony is, of course, when we look at when – and we're hearing a lot now about President Obama's legacy. He's in his last few months of office. He's thinking about legacies. Other people are writing about his legacy. He's got some things to be very proud of that are based on the triumph of diplomacy over war. He can point to the Iran nuclear deal, which was a hard-fought accomplishment against massive opposition in Congress, massive opposition from Israel, massive political opposition. But they got it through, and it's been a remarkably powerful, strong, negotiated deal. It has its problems, but it's avoided what was a potentially devastating war. He can point to Cuba, where after 50 years of crippling sanctions and a blockade, we're not all the way there yet. We don't have full normalization yet. But the U.S. is well on its way towards normalizing relations with Cuba. And all of that was done without firing a shot, eliminating the worst of the sanctions. Not all, but we're on the way. If you look at everywhere where the military has been the centerpiece of our policy, we've failed. And this global war on terror, it didn't just fail in some broad rhetorical sense. Yes, we've been at war with terror for 15 years and terrorism is doing just fine. I kind of like that line. It's quite accurate. But it isn't just that broad framework. It's also the failures you can point to in every one of those countries where that war has been waged. So start with Afghanistan, where we first went to war for the global war on terror. We've been having troops in Afghanistan for almost it'll be 15 and a half years now. You know, it's an extraordinary thing. At the end of the day, what do we see in Afghanistan? We see massive failure. Just last week, the Central Command reaffirmed that as of now, the Taliban controls more territory in Afghanistan than at any time since the U.S. overthrew the Taliban back in 2001. Great. 15 years of occupation have done great. And then you hear, well, at least the girls can go to school. At least children can get an education, which they couldn't under the Taliban. Well, there were plenty of problems under the Taliban. It was a repressive, horrific, misogynistic regime, no doubt. But what we've got now in a government led by corrupt politicians and a bunch of warlords whose own religious and political views are very, very similar to those of the Taliban. We just heard from the Special Inspector General for Afghanistan that over 42% of the children of Afghanistan have either never gone to school, or if they went at all, they were forced to leave school by the fifth grade at the most. Most have gotten no education at all. Why? Because most of the schools that were supposedly being built at enormous expense with our tax money by U.S.-paid contractors were simply never built at all. The few that were often collapsed in the first winter because they weren't built to withstand it, and they have no teachers. So the whole question of how the U.S. tried to operate in Afghanistan has been a fraud. It has accomplished nothing. When the U.S. invaded Afghanistan, Afghanistan was, according to UNICEF, the worst country in the world for a child to be born and survive to her first birthday, and the worst country in the world for a woman to give birth and survive. Today, it's still the worst country in the world for a woman to – I shouldn't say today. This was about 6 months ago. It may have changed by now. But it was still the worst country in the world for a woman to give birth and survive, and the second worst country in the world, Sierra Leone, came out ahead, if you will. So that's what we have to brag about after 15 years of military occupation. In Iraq, the next, if we go chronologically, the next country for the global war on terror, we see a government that is so incompetent that there is still only 6 or 7 hours of electricity for anybody in Baghdad and 4 or 5 or less for anybody else in the country. They've never been able to get the electricity working again after the war. And so incredibly sectarian as a Shia-dominated government and brutal in its treatment of the large Sunni minority, that a ton of Sunni, ordinary Sunni Iraqis are turning to ISIS as the lesser evil. Not because they're extremists, not because they're religious fanatics. I mean, I've met some of these Sunni generals. They are as secular as they come. They drink, they smoke, God knows what else they do. But they are not religious anything. But they are turning to ISIS because they see it as the potential for maybe they could get some support, some defense of their community against a sectarian government put in place, armed and paid by the United States with our tax money, despite the fact that they're more accountable to Iran than they are to us. But that government has been so repressive against ordinary Sunnis, from roundups of young Sunni men on the streets, torture in the prisons, bombing of a Sunni nonviolent protest camp. It's been really grim. So people are turning to ISIS and saying, well, maybe that's where we could get some kind of hope, some kind of support against this government. It's been a complete failure. In Yemen, Yemen's the poorest country in the Arab world, has been for decades. 80% of the population now is completely dependent on food for survival from the United Nations. The economy has been destroyed. People are being held in towns that have been under siege by the Saudi-led coalition that is dropping bombs that we provide from planes that we provide that are fueled in the air by our planes and our pilots. And we read in the New York Times today that for the first time, the U.S. is engaging in the war in Yemen. And I wanted to yell at somebody at the Times and say, what do you think in-air refueling is? Chopped liver? You know, it's like, what are you people thinking? This is the first time. They have been engaged in this war for the entire 15 months this war has been waged. What they did do for the first time today, or I guess yesterday, was to directly bomb the rebel forces in Yemen who are fighting back against the Saudi coalition bombing, who tried to bomb a U.S. warship and failed, and the U.S. went and bombed Yemen and took out 3 targeting things of some sort. I'm not quite sure what they were. Radar systems on the Yemeni coast. So now the U.S. is clearly fully directly involved. It certainly isn't the first time, as I mentioned earlier. But it has been an absolute failure. The Saudi war has led to enormous civilian casualties. You all know about the bombing of the funeral parlor 3-4 days ago now, where 140 people were killed right off the cuff. Another 500 to 600 have been injured, some of them badly enough that they will probably not survive. So the entire escalation of the Saudi war in Yemen is going forward with full U.S. backing, U.S. support. In Libya, again in the context of the Arab Spring, a crisis in Libya that leads to a call for a familiar word, a no-fly zone. And first the call comes from various European powers. It's quickly taken up in the U.S. by the then Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and others in the State Department. Hillary Clinton, who's supposed to be at that time the diplomat in chief, you would think she would have been calling for a diplomatic solution, but no, she was the one leading the call for a no-fly zone. The Secretary of Defense, the head of the Pentagon, who one would think would be calling for the military side, he was the one saying, no, we shouldn't be engaging. Why? Because he said, establishing a no-fly zone in Libya starts with going to war against Libya. This is Robert Gates in whatever it was, April or May of 2011, the Secretary of Defense, the Republican. He was the holdover from the Bush administration. President Obama had kept him on. And he's the one saying, it means we have to go to war with Libya. Why? Because the first thing you have to do in establishing a no-fly zone is take out the anti-aircraft system so that your patrols will be safe. Now, Libya at that time barely had an anti-aircraft system of any significance. But nonetheless, they went forward. Secretary Gates' position was defeated. Secretary Clinton's position was the one that ruled the day. The U.S. joined NATO and in a massive bombing campaign that, of course, led to the overthrow and ultimately the murder of Gaddafi. And crucially for the regional situation, as well as inside Libya, led to the throwing open of the doors of massive arms depots throughout the country. Those arms have now surfaced all throughout Central Africa, North Africa, throughout the greater Arab world. Basically, in all these conflicts, there are now Libyan arms that have been made available to pretty much anybody. Inside Libya, massive instability and massive violence, three separate governments, none of whom have any indigenous credibility. One is recognized by the UN, but none of them are seen as representing a unified country. It's a disaster. The disaster is not about the Hillary Clinton emails about Benghazi. That's not the disaster. The disaster is for the people of Libya and what's happened to their country. A lot of people at the time said that a no-fly zone is going to lead to regime change. And in the UN Security Council, the same argument was made. And people were somehow convinced that, no, 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 this is only about protecting civilians. This is not about regime change. And what a surprise. It got bad enough that the Secretary General of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in South Africa, which voted for the resolution authorizing this so-called no-fly zone to protect civilians, later apologized, said we should have known better. We should have known it would not be limited to a no-fly zone to protect civilians, that it would become regime change, and indeed it did. Syria, the centerpiece now of the worst of all of this, also in the context of the Arab Spring, begins with a nonviolent protest movement of Syrians fed up with a very brutal dictatorial regime, looking for political reforms, an end to mass arrests, an end to torture in prison, exacerbated somewhat by conditions created by climate change. One, you know, in the Arab Spring was a regional phenomenon, but it took very different form in different countries. And in Syria, one of those forms had to do with climate change, because there had been a three-year drought that led 800,000 Syrian farmers and their families to be driven off the land. They could no longer make a living. They were forced into the cities looking for work. Until about 10 years earlier, they might have found jobs, because at that time, the Syrian economy was a kind of state socialism of a sort, with a very enormous bloated state sector that could, you know, hire pretty much anybody they wanted. About a decade before, it had turned into a kind of neoliberal economy where there was a great deal of privatization. The state sector had been vastly diminished. So people flood into the cities looking for work. There's hardly any jobs. The jobs they do find tend to go to people who know someone in power. That means they're more likely than not to be an Alawite, because that's the religious identity of the ruling family, of the Assad family, and their closest circles. Doesn't mean that only Alawites got jobs, but it just means that it exacerbated the sectarianism that had not been a big issue in Syria historically. Historically, Syria, modern Syria, had been quite secular. But suddenly, sectarianism was a big factor. So you see in Syria, with the rise of ISIS, first in Iraq, the rise of ISIS, of course, one of the consequences of the U.S. invasion of Iraq. It emerged from a U.S.-run prison, Camp Buqqa, in Iraq, where hundreds and then thousands and then tens of thousands of Iraqis were rounded up and imprisoned. And let me just ask you something about this. This happened in 2004, in the first year of the U.S. war in Iraq. And at the time that the group that became ISIS, it didn't use that name at first, it was attached to Al-Qaeda earlier, it was much less religiously focused in its earlier iterations. But at that time, it was the same time as the Abu Ghraib scandal emerged. Now let me ask the students here, how many of you have heard of Abu Ghraib? Just a couple of you. You should raise this with some of your faculty here, because that's a problem that you don't know more about Abu Ghraib. Abu Ghraib is something that will haunt United States foreign policy for generations. Abu Ghraib was a prison in Iraq, where Iraqis that were picked up by the U.S. occupation forces were held and interrogated, and it turns out, humiliated and tortured routinely by U.S. soldiers. This had been going on in other prisons as well. It wasn't unique to Abu Ghraib. What was unique was that a set of photographs were leaked from Abu Ghraib. And those photographs made it onto the front page of every newspaper in the country and around the world. And those photographs showed U.S. soldiers, very young U.S. soldiers, humiliating, helpless, often naked Iraqi prisoners, sometimes with a dog collar around their neck and held on a dog leash, sometimes forced to pile on top of each other in piles of naked men. It was unspeakable humiliations and unspeakable torture. Every Iraqi prisoner in a U.S. prison in those days knew that he might face the same torture. Not everyone was, but they all knew it could happen because it had happened, it had been documented, and the whole world now knew about it. It's now the symbol for Iraqis of what the U.S. occupation looked like. So in that context, that's what led to the creation of what became ISIS. ISIS becomes strong for some of the reasons I mentioned. Iraqis who are very secular in other ways, and some of them are generals, some of them have their arms, join with ISIS. They become much stronger than they would on their own. They're powerful because they don't fight alone. And suddenly they're over the border into Syria, wiping out the colonial border and saying, we are establishing this caliphate on territory across both Iraq and Syria. So the Syria war takes on this incredibly complex character. It's no longer just either a political or even an armed struggle between opposition forces and the regime. There's now both Syrian but especially regional Islamist forces, extremist forces flooding into Syria as well as into Iraq. And then global Islamist forces are coming in to join, to be part of this caliphate. So it complicates everything as we move towards the period where we see these proxy wars that I mentioned earlier.
Phyllis Benes with part one of Ending the Many Wars in Syria. She spoke in Boston on October 13, 2016. Many thanks to Dave Goodman of IBIS Radio for the fine recording. That's www.ibisradio.org. And we are at newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, thanking you for listening, advising illegitimi non carborundum, reminding you that an injury to one is an injury to all, and hoping you'll tune in again next week when we'll have part two of Benes's talk. Y'all come back now here. Ciao.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, 9/11 wake up call.
I'm sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded. true. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. No short.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Today you'll hear the speech given by author and New York University professor Mark Crispin Miller, given at the Left Forum on May 30th, 2015. He's the author of the book Fooled Again on election fraud in 2004 and has written several other books and made a movie about the crackdown on our civil liberties called Orwell Rolls in His Grave. My apologies in advance for some of the sound quality. The speech was taped live, so you can hear background noises and the frequent opening and closing of the door. But I think it's a speech really worth hearing. So here he is, Mark Crispin Miller, at the Left Forum, talking about the left and 9/11.
Of course, we want to bring this subject to the public and debate it at the very highest levels. Naturally, we do. I mean, there's no question but that a lot of really bad has happened since 9/11. It seems glaringly obvious that it's happened. So why is it that it's not being debated nationally? And why is it that the left isn't talking about it? Because it isn't. And I'm not as sanguine as you are about the possibility of it happening. And my assignment here today is to talk about why that is, why it's not being debated, and why so much of the left won't talk about it. It is good news that there are four panels here on this subject. That's a definite step forward. Let me add that 9/11 is on everybody's lips by contrast with the problem of election fraud and stolen elections, which is completely taboo. The theft of elections in this country is inextricably related to 9/11. If Bush-Cheney hadn't stolen that election, 9/11 wouldn't have happened. Well, I don't want to get lost in the weeds here. Let me begin by reading to you a recent movie review that takes a shot at me. And this isn't just grandiosity or self-advertising. You'll see that it's directly related to the subject that we're dealing with today. This is from a review of a new documentary called The True Cost, which is about fashion, just coming out now. This review ran in the Daily Beast. It's written by a fashion writer named Lizzie Crocker. She goes through the film, and then she writes this: materialistic, money-grubbing Americans shouldn't kid themselves. All of that stuff they're buying is making them depressed, despite the promise of happiness and consumerism that the advertising industry is selling us. So much for the American dream. But this is where the film loses focus and credibility, criticizing not just the fashion industry, but the global capitalist system that supports it. NYU media professor Mark Crispin Miller denounces advertising as sinister propaganda. Scare quotes around propaganda and sinister. Quote, we think of propaganda as a totalitarian thing. We think of Hitler. But propaganda is actually as American as apple pie, Miller tells us. I think that's an uncontroversial observation. And in fact, the Daily Beast put that quote in a box at the side of the review. Okay, so clearly it's something people will read and say, yeah, right? But Lizzie Crocker begs to differ. The film neglects to mention that Miller is a 9/11 truther, a once-respected writer and political activist whose views have become too fringe for even the most extremist pockets of the mainstream. Yeah, right, what? I didn't know there were any extremist pockets in the mainstream, much less most extremist pockets. But however demented they are, I'm too psychotic even for them. By including people like Miller, the film presumes that its target audience is both ignorant and impressionable. Either we won't recognize Miller as a conspiracy theorist, or we will, but are too open-minded to dismiss his opinions about advertising. Yeah, just try to process that, okay? They're not opinions, you know. It's a historical fact. Advertising is a form of propaganda. It's commercial propaganda. And into the 30s, in the advertising trade press, you'll find the word propaganda used by people in advertising to refer to what they do. but it's an opinion, and it's an opinion that on its face should be rejected out of hand, especially because of my background as a 9/11 truther. Okay, now, there's a few things to say about this. One is that this is a kind of minor historical point, but it's worth making, that the charge of conspiracy theory is kind of descendant of red baiting, right? Because her entree to this attack on me and on the film for using me is the fact that the film is not content simply to take issue with advertising, but it actually raises questions about the global capitalist system that supports it, okay? Therefore, you know, the film has to be condemned and so on. But the more important point is that Lizzie Crocker is not at all unusual in her readiness to level this charge against me, even though I wasn't talking about 9/11 in the film. And even though I'm not actually, by any stretch of the imagination, a full-time 9/11 truther. I mean, I speak at events like this. I'm very sympathetic, but I can't pretend to be on the same level with people like Les and David Ray Griffin and so on. Nevertheless, the fact that I'm open to this at all is grounds for complete and utter condemnation, no matter what I'm talking about. So, you know, the bigotedness of this response is startling. But more important than that is the fact that it comes to her fingertips so readily. And that's the problem that we're up against. We're up against the problem of the conspiracy theory meme that anyone who talks about this is self-evidently nuts. That this is just crazy on its face that this would ever happen. I am confident in saying that Lizzie Crocker has never spent a second looking into the evidence that 9/11... I'm not even going to say 9/11 was an inside job. I'm sort of going to say the copious evidence that the official story is preposterous. We can say that we can all agree, okay? The official story is preposterous. There is an enormous and ever-growing library of hard evidence to that effect. So why aren't we all talking about this? Why are the American people not discussing this? Why isn't this headline news? Why isn't there another commission planned? Which is the whole point of the 9/11 truth movement, is another commission. That's all it is. Precisely because that is a reasonable request and something that wouldn't be difficult to arrange, it is necessary to demonize the people who are asking for it. Now, conspiracy theory. My own career was indeed derailed. Lizzie Crocker's right about the fact that I once had entree to NPR radio shows. I talked often. I was writing about so-called popular culture. I wrote about TV. So reporters would always call me up to ask me what I thought of Britney Spears or, you know, some bolt like that. And advertising and so on, you know, harmless subjects. When I published Fooled Again, which argues that the 2004 election was stolen, as the expression has it, I couldn't get arrested. Although it's an unfortunate expression because who knows, right? But what I mean is I was blacklisted. The book was blacked out. I got 2 newspaper reviews in the whole country, 1 positive, 1 negative. Could not get any interviews on NPR. A friend of mine who has a small foundation in Philadelphia offered to put up the money to pay for ads for the book that would run on WHYY, which is the Philadelphia NPR affiliate. And they said, sure, we do that all the time. So he and I wrote some 30-second spots about the book. And he sent them in, and he didn't hear back. He followed up with a phone call, and they said, well, no, see, we don't really do political advertising. He said, we're not asking you to do political advertising. Mark Crispin Miller isn't running for office. He wrote a book about the 2004 election. And the reply to that was, we're not going to just advertise any book. I mean, we wouldn't advertise Mein Kampf.
What?
Yes. We wouldn't advertise Mein Kampf. Mein Kampf. All right. So I was a conspiracy theorist. Everybody who wrote about the issue was a conspiracy theorist. What I went through, Bob went through, Steve Freeman at Penn, is he? Went through. Bobby Kennedy Jr. went through. It's conspiracy theory. No matter how well argued, no matter how amply documented, we're talking about conspiracy theory. It can't be true. It's not possible. They wouldn't steal an election. Not in this country.
Okay? They might do it in Russia or in Venezuela, but they're not going to do it here. It is self-evidently preposterous. Okay, I was so stunned by this because it was a major mainstream publishing house that did the book. It was Basic Books. And I even hired, as an outside publicist, Barbara Montero, who's Paul Krugman's publicist, and who has had much experience in getting people on shows like Charlie Rose and that. And she'd never seen anything like the brick wall that she ran into with Fooled Again. Now, I tell you all this, I'm not whining to you. I'm telling you this to explain why I decided to research the origins of that meme conspiracy theory. When did that start? Where did that come from? Because the fact is, it's a fairly recent development. And I was in touch with Lance DeHaven Smith, as a name some of you may know, who had written a great essay on conspiracy theory. So I asked him to write a whole book on it for a series I was editing published by the University of Texas Press. And I strongly recommend the book to you if you haven't read it. It's called Conspiracy Theory in America. And what it demonstrates is the following. Until 1967, the phrase conspiracy theory rarely came up in American journalistic discourse. If you do a search in the archives of the New York Times, Washington Post, and Time magazine, do a search on the phrase conspiracy theory, you find that it's rarely used, and when it is used, it's used in various ways, in various contexts. There's nothing consistent about its use. Suddenly, in 1967, it starts appearing all over the place, and increasingly, through the rest of the 60s and into the 70s and ever since, and it's always used in the same way. Well, I should say about 90% of the time, it's used in the same way. It's used to discredit arguably left critiques or discussions of state crimes against democracy. Okay, not just 9/11, but the Kennedy assassination, the Kennedy assassinations, I should say, Martin Luther King, Iran-Contra, the CIA's drug dealing in the inner city, election fraud, and latterly, the Boston Marathon bombing. We could go on, okay?
The sound quality for the next few minutes of Mark Crispin Miller's speech became inaudible. So here's a brief summary of what he said. In 1967, after two books came out that were critical of the Warren Commission, the CIA sent a memo to all of its station chiefs worldwide, urging them to use their propaganda assets and friends in the media to discredit the work of conspiracy theorists, and they even laid out the five tactics to be used to do this. And one was by using the phrase, "If there was a real conspiracy going on, somebody would have talked." Mark Crispin Miller also said that he gets that one a lot concerning election fraud. If the election was stolen, someone would have talked.
You know, people have talked all over the place. But it doesn't matter. It's not the truth of the argument that matters. It's just its rhetorical efficacy. See? And then on the 50th anniversary of Kennedy's assassination, we saw that these arguments were used again. They came up again. People actually still arguing with their bare faces hanging out that Lee Harvey Oswald killed JFK alone, which is a ludicrous narrative. It's as ludicrous as the official 9/11 story. It's as ludicrous as the argument that Bush Cheney won the 2004 election because the Christian vote came out. The Christians suddenly started to multiply like Jesus' loaves and fishes and voted in huge multitudes that no one knew existed, and then he was reelected despite his record disapproval ratings and his unpopularity within the Republican Party and so on. That doesn't really matter. Fact is that the official truth is the truth, regardless of what you may say against it, and anything you say against it or say to question it is a conspiracy theory. It comes from the CIA. I would argue that it is probably the most effective propaganda drive in American history. Maybe even world history. Because as Lance points out in his book, what it did, what it has done, is to effect a profound change in the worldview of the American people, who since the revolution have always been ready to believe that elites are capable of conspiracy against the rights and property of the American people. That is not a radical assumption. That's a common sense view. The Declaration of Independence is a conspiracy theory from beginning to end. That's what it is. The idea that elites were after us, that they couldn't be trusted, they were in cahoots with the British Empire and so on, This was common currency under Andrew Jackson. And through the 19th century, you find it in the writings of Abraham Lincoln. You know, it's just not that radical an idea. Moreover, it is a kind of natural and healthy suspiciousness that is essential to the maintenance of democracy. When you internalize this idea that there's something crazy about the thought of the elites conspiring like this, when you internalize that idea, you are crippled. You are incapacitated. You can't any longer talk honestly about what's going on and what the framers understood would happen. You spoke about how the state of war has had all these dire effects. Well, that's why the framers, and I'm not, you know, idealizing the framers. I mean, they, in their own way, they conspired against the common people and so on, and they defended slavery. We know all this. Nevertheless, they were classical small-R Republicans. They knew that you had to limit presidential power. You couldn't give the president power to declare war. You couldn't and shouldn't have a standing army. Compare that vision with what we have today, with this grotesque, distended military establishment that's both public and private, with a president who makes war constantly. I think this is the most warlike president we've ever had. The fact is that right in the American tradition, there has always been a kind of salutary distrust of executive power that's kind of vanished now. Because when people notice that something's fishy about a story that they've heard, they are always inclined to apologize by saying, well, I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but. You've heard people say this, right? Well, I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but. Then they'll say something perfectly reasonable that anybody would say. It's like, I'm not a feminist, but. You probably heard that too. I'm not a feminist, but. American history is in many ways a series of provocations, strategic provocations, like 9/11, although that's in a class by itself because it's so horrific. So the point I just made is that ideologically and philosophically, the 9/11 truth movement is actually as American as apple pie. Moreover, even a cursory awareness or understanding of American history allows us to recognize that this tactic of deliberately inflaming public opinion by arranging a provocative act goes all the way back to the Mexican War in the 1840s. You know, when James Polk deliberately sent General Zachary Taylor to Mexico and get the Mexicans to attack so that we could counterattack. This is arguably what happened to bring on the Spanish-American War when the Maine blew up, with the battleship Maine. And there's a tape of Bobby Kennedy actually discussing the explosion of the Maine during the Cuban Missile Crisis, and he refers to it just in passing as a deliberate provocation by the U.S. FDR's record, I mean, we've talked about Pearl Harbor, and this is extremely upsetting to Democrats and liberals generally, and I understand why it is. But Pearl Harbor was not the only provocation that FDR, he was also, they were chasing U-boats all over the North Atlantic trying to get them to attack our ships. And Hitler was not going to take the bait because he didn't want to fight two wars at once, not because he was a great guy, okay? Even though I am, of course, on a par with Hitler. My books are so similar to his works. Tell. And then we all know about the Gulf of Tonkin. That's something that we can instantly think of. After the Cuban Revolution, the personnel in Guantanamo began a series of provocations, including the abduction and murder of at least four Cuban nationals. The number of provocations by the U.S. military personnel at Guantanamo eventually numbered over 13,000. Cuba kept complaining about this to the UN. The Cubans weren't going to give them the benefit of succumbing to a provocation. So this is something that's happened time and time and time and time and time again. And since 9/11, we've seen this happen repeatedly with the anthrax mailings, and I believe the Boston Marathon bombing, and Charlie Hebdo. I mean, we can go on and on. Now, let me read you a passage from the Nuremberg Diary by G.M. Gilbert, who was an American psychiatrist who was assigned to Nuremberg prison. And he interviewed all the accused, and one of them was Hermann Göring. And they had this fascinating exchange. "Why, of course the people don't want war," Göring shrugged. "Why should some poor slob on a farm want to risk his life in a war when the best that he can get out of it is to come back to his farm in one piece? Naturally, the common people don't want war, neither in Russia, nor in England, nor in America, nor for that matter in Germany. That is understood. But after all, it is the leaders of the country who determine the policy, and it is always a simple matter to drag the people along, whether it is a democracy or a fascist dictatorship or a parliament or a communist dictatorship. Gilbert is troubled by this, and he says, I mean, I could kiss the guy. Bless his heart. It's heartbreaking. He says, there is one difference, I pointed out. In a democracy, the people have some say in the matter through their elected representatives. And in the United States, only Congress can declare wars. Oh, that is all well and good, Goering replies. But voice or no voice, the people can always be brought to the bidding of the leaders. That's easy. All you have to do is tell them that they're being attacked and denounce the pacifists for lack of patriotism and exposing the country to danger. It works the same way in any country. It's not controversial. Now, where's the left in all this? The more persuasive the 9/11 truth movement becomes, and the more people go online and pick stuff up that the mainstream media doesn't want them to know, and the more young people come of age unintimidated by the conspiracy theory meme, that's very important. And I've noticed this in my own classes. It keeps me going. It's like homophobia. I mean, they don't really care. They'll kind of look at the evidence and have a normal, sane reaction to it. The easier it gets, the more promising our prospects, the more the state ramps up their drive against us, slanderous and subversive efforts to cripple the movement. You may know that David Cameron last fall, in a speech before the UN, said that conspiracy theory is as dangerous as ISIS. Okay? And he meant what we're doing, conspiracy theory. Recently, François Hollande, the socialist president of France, equated conspiracy theory with Nazism. Because, of course, anti-Semitism is based on an ancient conspiracy theory of, you know, Jewish machinations, etc. And here in our own country, as I'm sure you know, because the choir is here, Cass Sunstein, who's working for President Obama, co-wrote a piece for a journal published by Harvard University on cognitive infiltration that is using trolls deliberately to subvert discussions of 9/11 online. I mean, he actually talked about the necessity of disabling this dangerous terroristic discourse by using agents to go online posing as sympathizers, picking fights. I have no doubt also people will go on a 9/11 site and start talking about the protocols of the Elders of Zion and the Jewish world conspiracy so that the 9/11 movement gets tarnished with a kind of neo-Nazi brush. I mean, if I were doing this kind of thing, that's what I would do, right? So this isn't just empty words we're talking about. This is kind of manifest preparation to criminalize the kind of discussion we're having and to use all the powers of the state to shut it down. Now, where's the left? Where's the left in all this? Where is it? Let's go back to 67 when the CIA sent out this memo. Right around the same time, Ramparts, the leftist magazine, was breaking these amazing stories about what the CIA was up to. In 66, they broke the story of how Michigan State University had played a crucial role in propping up the Diem dictatorship in South Vietnam. A professor at MSU, Stanley Scheinbaum, blew the whistle on this because he was actually involved in the program and he realized they were training police at Michigan State University. This was broken by Ramparts. The following year, they broke the story of the National Student Association being subsidized by the CIA. That story exploded in the mainstream press. The New York Times did an excellent job following up on that story, interviewing kids who had unwittingly been dragged into the CIA operation, threatened with long federal jail terms if they told anybody about it. I mean, it was really harrowing. I cannot imagine anything like that happening now. I don't see the left any longer doing those kinds of exposés. And I believe that if you study the history of the New York Review of Books, and The Nation, even the New York Times Book Review, and other publications like that do a content analysis of those publications from then through the 70s into now, you'll see that this kind of explosive content just stops. It stops. We don't see it anymore. And now we've come to the point where some of our most illustrious fellow leftists actually go out of their way to disavow any kind of discussion like the discussion we're having. I'm going to read you, I'm concluding with this. This is a passage from Disaster Capitalism by Naomi Klein, a work that's the subject of a panel here at the Left Forum, a book that I deeply admire, and I think the world of her. I mean, she's kind of a friend of mine. Nevertheless, I am struck by this passage. When the September 11th attacks hit, the White House was packed with Milton Friedman's disciples, including Donald Rumsfeld. The Bush team seized the moment of collective vertigo with chilling speed. Not, as some have claimed, because the administration deviously plotted the crisis, but because the key figures of the administration, veterans of earlier disaster capitalism experiments in Latin America and Eastern Europe, were part of a movement that prays for crisis the way drought-struck farmers pray for rain and the way Christian Zionist end-timers pray for the rapture. When the long-awaited disaster strikes, they know instantly that their moment has come at last. So they didn't have anything to do with its happening. They were just poised. Poised to write the Patriot Act in 12 hours. You ever seen it? You know, right? They just quickly wrote that because they were praying for a crisis, and it struck. They said, great, quick, hurry up. Let's get a few people and write that Patriot Act. Right? Now, what's especially remarkable about this is that Naomi Klein knows that the U.S. had actually itself been involved in some of those earlier disaster capitalism experiments in Latin America. It's in the same book. It's about 60 pages later. She talks about how the CIA and ITT worked to destroy Chilean democracy by arranging for the Pinochet coup. She writes very intelligently about this, that it wasn't like the U.S. was praying for a coup in Chile and then acted with chilling speed to take advantage of it. That coup was their doing. She knows this. What I therefore conclude, Naomi Klein just doesn't want to go there. I don't think it's a calculation. I think it's an instinctive thing. You go there, you are off the reservation. You are basically asking to be shot, metaphorically speaking. It's professional suicide. You're asking to be Gary Webbed. You know what I'm, you understand? That Gary Webb, his life was destroyed by the charge of conspiracy theory. And I know journalists personally who, even journalists who've written about some of the major conspiracies of the last 30 years, they become anxious to the point of belligerence if you talk to them about this stuff. They don't want to go there, and it upsets them to be asked to go there because, on some level, being serious journalists, they know that they should go there. But this has been such a successful effort to stigmatize a particular kind of necessary investigation that our journalists across the political spectrum have been disabled by it, you know? And I've seen it with election fraud. When Michael Moore, another friend, announced right after the 2004 election on his website that it was not stolen, it just wasn't. So the question becomes, how do we deal with this? I know a lot of people on the left, colleagues at NYU, staunch left people coming to this event who don't even know some of the basic stuff about what the 9/11 truth movement has unearthed. They have never heard it. It's like it's in a bad part of town and they would never go there. You know, they just have stayed away. So they will ask a sort of fundamental question that just leaves you gaping. And you have to reinvent the wheel and tell them all the stuff, you know. And sometimes they'll, yeah, wow, that's interesting. But that's the end of it. They won't then become interested enough to devote attention to it and circulate because it's disreputable. It's disreputable. So that's the challenge here. I'll stop there.
And that concludes the speech given by Mark Crispin Miller at the Left Forum in New York City on May 30th, 2015. You can find that speech and the Q&A that followed on YouTube by searching for Mark Crispin Miller and Left Forum. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, building bridges.
This is Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg.
The consequences of the new technological revolution are about to hit hard. Unemployment will spike as new technologies replace labor in the manufacturing, service, and professional sectors in an economy that is already floundering. And Robert McChesney argues in People Get Ready, the fight against a jobless economy and a citizenless democracy, that only the dramatic democratization of our economy can address the challenges we now face. Senator Bernie Sanders, actually, in praise and promotion of People Get Ready, wrote that they, Robert McChesney and John Nichols, call us, as Tom Paine did more than two centuries ago, to turn knowledge into power. Now, Professor McChesney, who has authored and edited 23 books, whose work has been translated into 31 languages, helps us to figure out how we can turn knowledge into power. Thanks for joining us.
It's my pleasure, Mimi.
Well, certainly it's an essential challenge of these times to ensure that technology is used to serve the whole of humanity rather than to enrich further the wealthy few and create the circumstances that drives the working class into joblessness or habitual state of precarity. Bob, how or why really have you chosen this moment to become the town crier to warn against the advance of technology, from robotization and artificial intelligence and its effect on our being able to earn a livelihood?
It's a book really as much about capitalism, current capitalism, and the current lack of democracy as technology. But technology is a dynamic element that is really going to produce tremendous changes in that context. And I think the idea for the book began in 2014 when Eric Schmidt, the CEO at Google, gave the keynote at Davos in Switzerland, which is the annual meeting of all the world's financial, business, and political elites, where they discuss the great problems facing them and the world. And Schmidt said to his fellow billionaires and global leaders that Google then and other companies in the United States and worldwide were working on a wave of technologies that in the very near future were going to wipe out most of the middle-class jobs, and that a large chunk of jobs that people had taken for granted were going to be eliminated by business and technology in the coming decade or two. And what Schmidt said that was striking to us was that unemployment and underemployment and just sort of general downward pressure on working conditions and wages would be the number one political issue worldwide and in the United States for the next 20 or 30 years. And he said it in such a striking manner that it got my attention, my co-author John Nichols' attention. And we were wondering, first of all, if Schmidt was telling the truth or he was just blowing smoke. And secondly, we were wondering why no one else was talking about this outside of elites, if in fact this was true. And we did the research. We read the business engineering material on automation, robots, artificial intelligence, what's taking place in labor practices, and indeed confirmed that what he is saying is pretty much acknowledged by people who study the matter closely. And then we looked around and said, well, if this is the case, why is it that's nowhere really to be found in our political debates, in the broader political discussion among the population? It's purely, at this point, a discussion of elites, by and for elites. And that's when we decided this is a book that really needs to be written.
Is the issue, as a result of this, the wiping out of jobs, the wiping out of the middle class and the working class, is the issue that the democratization that is referred to really means that the U.S. working class has to push aggressively for a new economic structure in which technologies are applied to effectively address environmental and social problems, unlike that would be used by the capitalist class?
Absolutely. I think that is precisely the logical endpoint of the discussion. I mean, there's really, in elite circles, there is an understanding that the immediate consequence of of the ability of businesses to switch to these new labor-saving technologies. And again, when we talk about this, it's not simply extraordinary robots in manufacturing. But we're talking about very few jobs that aren't going to be, they're not in the process right now of being greatly automated. So it cuts all across, I mean, up to professional level jobs and above that these will affect. And if you talk to elite circles, they're arguing, they understand that in the near term there's going to be massive dislocation. And that's what they're looking at, because for businesses, they can save so much money by investing in robots, artificial intelligence, computerization of employment. But they sort of hold the faith that in time, business will come up with new jobs, new sectors, and they will all live happily ever after. And there's a certain amount of history to back this up. I mean, most people worked on farms in the 19th century. And when farming became far more automated, or at least productive with machinery, those workers left the land and they went to the cities and found jobs in factories. And when factories became far more productive with machinery, those workers went into offices and other places. And it seemed like there were all these jobs that eventually came around to work for people, with the exception, perhaps, of the Great Depression. And we think that that's the argument we hear today, but there's really no evidence for it. And we studied it pretty closely and looked at the claims. And I think those that actually examine the claims understand that there isn't another wave of tens of millions of jobs that's going to show up. But this revolution we're in technologically is so profound that it is really the equivalent of a steam engine, if not greater, in terms of the impact it'll have on the economy. And we're completely unprepared for it within our current political economy. It's going to immediately accrue benefits to those who run the government, who run the policies, and who own the economy. And the benefits for the rest of the population are purely, at this point, hypothetical, and almost would require magic to come about.
And why wouldn't capital, not seeing the kind of impending disaster, although one could certainly project a closer movement to fascism, but why would it not then say that we really need to expand the technology into greening the economy, for example, and virtually put itself out of business or create a real crisis, since it still needs a consumer class to buy its products?
Well, you're right, and there's just now the beginning of that sort of discussion in elite circles. I think at this point, there's so much still people, even in elite circles, or especially in elite circles, will hold on to the magic of the market combined with the magic of technology, which is this very powerful cocktail that people drink in this country, that they think the same technologies that eliminate all these jobs will be creating new ones, and they think the technologies are so wonderful they'll overwhelm the temporary disruption that they anticipate. But there are some who understand that we're looking at a situation where unemployment and underemployment and downward pressure on living conditions, already a major problem worldwide, even before we talk about this, and that's the context we're in, already a huge problem in the United States, not only in communities of color, which are sort of the first ones who've experienced the massive wave of the warehousing of people and underemployment and unemployment, but really stretching all across large chunks of rural America today, turning much of the rural United States into effectively Appalachia. And with all this going on, that there's going to be a major problem. And I think right now they're struggling to come up with solutions that will save their economic system, save the privileges of the wealthy, so they can still have the wonderful benefits they've had, but have a stable society where people won't be so uppity they'll take to the streets and raise hell and disrupt what would otherwise be a lovely experience for the people who own the robots, own the companies that make the money. And somehow they want to salvage capitalism. So there is that debate from an elite perspective, how they can keep their system going. But there's not a debate yet, and there's not a movement yet that actively and aggressively says, well, how do we turn the situation into a plus for the bulk of the people in the United States and on the planet? And that's what we're trying to stimulate with this book.
Well, how do you see rejuvenating and extending democratic organization and movement to challenge this jobless future?
You know, what's ironic is when we started this book about a couple of years ago, we did our research on it. We went and we looked back at the 1930s. This was the last period where we had massive joblessness and underemployment of a long-term nature, not just of a brief slump, but deep and protracted. United States and much of the advanced capitalist world, unemployment rates got in the 20, 25, even 30% range. Extraordinary numbers. Even today, we'd be, that's something we can hardly fathom. And we looked at what happened politically in those environments. And what we found was that there were basically three things that happened in massively unemployed situations. One, the center usually collapsed, the mainstream, the establishment, usually mired in corruption and ineffectivity, and they couldn't come up with solutions that could get the economy working again, and they were in the pocket of those who were not willing to make change. So, that was one thing that occurred in most countries. Secondly, we found that as the center collapsed, as the mainstream collapsed, there were two great movements in Western capitalist societies. One tended to be things like we associate with FDR and the New Deal, which were progressive movements that tried to empower the working class, had the government enter and play a progressive role in creating jobs, lowering inequality, strengthening democracy, and strengthening the economy, and then building and actually making capitalism, ironically, work better by building up a working class with incomes to buy stuff and giving capitalists an incentive to invest because they were sitting on their capital. And the other side of the coin, though, as we well know, is that's the birth of fascism, as we know it in the modern sense. Without massive unemployment, the Nazis never would have come to power in Germany. Everyone who studies Germany gets that. I mean, Germany was not some backwater hit country. Germany was, the most dominant cultural, economic, and political force in Germany in the first part of the 20th century. And no one thought it was possible to have the fascists take power there until shortly before they actually did. Mm. And so we projected, as we started in our research, that as that situation arises in the United States and worldwide increasingly, we should see the center collapse. And certainly the center in the United States politics is completely corrupt and is not especially productive. But we'll also see movements here, we argued, for democratic socialism on the left and for fascism on the right. And when we first wrote this in our first chapter about a year ago, we sent it to our editor in New York, and she said, you can't write something about democratic socialism and fascism in a book for Americans. They're never going to buy that. That term means nothing. Those terms mean nothing here. And then a few months later, she wrote back by the end of the year and said, you guys, this was, of course, after Sanders and Trump made their moves, that you guys might be on to something here. And I think this is sort of the general scenario we're going to be seeing politically, and not just in the United States, but worldwide, as solutions to the crisis. They're going to be emerging. We're seeing them. They're emerging, in fact, this year much faster than we had anticipated. Both the Sanders and Trump phenomena have come much faster. And they are, in the end, I think, why they're so profound is that they are bottom responses to the great changes taking place to the bulk of the American population, something the corporate news media and NPR sort of stuck in their upper class, upper west side, Beltline cocoon, have no idea that's going on. They're still completely clueless about.
When I was reading the book, one of the things that I went back to, you went certainly looked at the 1930s, and I want to pick up on that in a minute. But I was also thinking about the agendarizing in many ways of Martin Luther King Jr. when he spoke towards the issue of another America. And what we looked at was the three pillars, if you will, of capitalism, the wealth disparity, the income distribution, the poverty, and the U.S. militarism, and the culture and practice of discrimination and disparate treatment that really curses through the political bloodstream of America. And I think that's very much in the book, and actually one might almost talk about that as the agenda in terms of structuring or restructuring and working to democratic institutions that will address this impending catastrophe. And I'm just wondering about your thoughts on that, and also if you can pick up more on some of the, shall we say, point headings that were addressed from the 1930s that begin to give us a sense of how to proceed.
Yeah, I'm glad you make that point, because our argument is that the crisis that's coming is a political crisis, first and foremost. I mean, it's fed by technology, and it's fed by a capitalist economy that's been mired in stagnation for some time now, and is only going to get worse thanks to what's coming with the technology. But it's a political crisis, so that's why we look so closely at the 30s and 40s, because that's when we had a similar situation of massive unemployment and we wanted to look and see how the response was then. And what was striking to us doing our research was that President Franklin Roosevelt was really almost obsessed with fascism and defeating it by the 1940s, by the Second World War, when the United States and the Allies were battling Germany and Japan. And he framed the entire Second World War as the battle of democracy against fascism. And he really spent a lot of time thinking, what caused fascism? What do we have to do to prevent fascism from returning anywhere in the world, and especially in the United States? He had no illusions that fascism was just something you find in other countries. He understood well that there were the same problems and threat of fascism here in the United States. And what's striking is that he gave two great speeches in the Second World War to define fascism and what needs to be done to defeat it. These were not minor speeches. They were not sort of things he said that just someone dug out of his archives. These were sort of framing speeches for his entire administration and legacy that he gave in the 1940s. And the first one was defining the war against fascism, Second World War, as the war for the four freedoms. And the four great freedoms included the freedom from militarism. He understood militarism was a key part of what makes societies anti-democratic and undemocratic, and was a key component of fascism. It's the policy they always turn to as the one way to stimulate the economy that wouldn't threaten elite interests. And also the freedom from want, that a democratic society had to have, a genuinely democratic society to exist and survive, had to have people who were secure and not in fear of their own survival materially. And then in 1944, he gave what I believe is the most important speech of his political career, the State of the Union Address. He's looking at the end of the war, and he argued that the Constitution of the United States had to be expanded, and we had to add a number of amendments to guarantee the security of the people in order to guarantee that fascism would never return. And it's called his famous Second Bill of Rights, or Economic Bill of Rights speech. And in that speech, he said that we needed to actually have a rights in the Constitution, in the Bill of Rights. We had to have another set of things that were guaranteed to everyone in America, a job at a living wage, housing, food, health care as a right, education as a right, and the right not to have monopolies dominate the economy. Because he said fascism is invariably when private monopolies, capitalist firms grew so large they took over the government and made it their own plaything and destroyed the credibility of democracy. And so he argued this is what we needed. Now, he didn't get that passed. And we go into this in great length in the book. We talk about the tremendous influence that speech and that those ideas had worldwide and had to this day. But he died before anything could happen there, and it never got passed, obviously. And the Cold War sort of swept much of that impetus for that under the rug. In the 1960s, Martin Luther King and the great labor leader, A. Philip Randolph, when they put together their freedom budget and their vision for how America should go, drew liberally from FDR's vision of how America should change into much more of a democratic socialist or social democratic society and much more egalitarian society. And then it's interesting to bring it full circle. Last year when Bernie Sanders was asked to define his vision of socialism, at your speech at Georgetown University, he basically started with and drew from those two experiences, the experience of FDR's State of the Union Address to the Second Bill of Rights and Martin Luther King and A. Philip Randolph's Freedom Budget. Said this is really the great American tradition we should understand for dealing with the crisis we're in now and the sort of society we should be building. And I think so the hopeful part of our book is there are rich traditions there to draw from. We're not going into this clueless or without anything to learn from, and that there's really a vision for how we can get through this, make this, instead of being some sort of cataclysmic crisis of, you know, dystopian Mel Gibson-type movie, instead be something that could be truly extraordinary.
So we're also advocating, instead of necessarily becoming a Luddite and going around and smashing up all the machinery, which there may be something to be said for, I really encourage people to get ready to read People Get Ready, The Fight Against a Jobless Economy and a Citizenless Democracy, because we've just skim the surface. There's so much more, looking at the issue of progressive taxation and looking at the issue, of course, that came out of the 30s of the GI bills and other things, that we really need to effectuate an agenda towards the end of transformative social and political structures. I just want to take a moment, since you're such an expert in this area and since you brought up Bernie Sanders, etc., while we're again telling people to get people get ready, and perhaps we can get Bob McChesney into New York on a sponsored book tour with WBAI. But your views on the way the media has looked to the primarily, I would say, the Sanders and the Trump campaign. I'm still reeling from the very first announcement by Trump in New York of his virulent hatred, which was voiced so prominently against various ethnicities, particularly people of Mexican descent, et cetera. And yet there was not a peep of any significance from the papers that covered it. But I'm giving my speech here. Your thoughts?
Well, that's a great question, and that is definitely hard to answer in a short answer, but I will just put it bluntly like this, or in a simplification. You know, in Dollarocracy, a book I wrote with John Nichols about money and media and politics that came out a few years ago, you know, we looked at all the literature, and it generally shows that corporate mainstream media, NPR, are not don't have a bias between Republicans and Democrats. They have a bias towards front runners who tend to have a lot of money, and they tend to treat them the best. But, you know, I think that whole logic collapses when you introduce someone like Bernie Sanders into the mix. Unquestionably, the data shows, and I think the anecdotal experience shows, that the corporate news media and NPR are spoon-feeding us sort of Hillary Clinton stuff. I mean, it's almost like her campaign is sort of the news director at every one of these stations. And Bernie Sanders is just treated like, you know, a pariah. And has been all along. It's been quite extraordinary. I've never seen anything quite like it. And I think it establishes where, when you strip away the hot air and get right to it, he is a genuine threat to the sort of moneyed establishment in this country that owns the media, and that the world of the journalists, all of them, including the MSNBC crowd, is very much tied up in the success of elites like Hillary Clinton in the mainstream, the corporate wing of the Democratic Party. And so it's really been quite stunning to see the nature of this media coverage as I've seen it unfold. And Trump, on the other hand, there, you know, his situation is, again, quite interesting, too. And it's a little different because it's a different set of criteria. And he's gotten such extraordinary coverage, and he's gotten away with the sort of comments you made that would have been career-enders in the past for anyone to make these sort of outrageous statements. And the list is so long, you can hardly remember them all at this point. Yet he still gets a ton of coverage. And since these criticisms of him haven't stuck, and the media will not hit him hard on some of these issues in a way they ought to. So this year has been, I think, perhaps the single most depressing year for looking at what passes for political journalism in the United States and how truly pathetic it is. And it makes it the need for stations like this one, for independent news media, that much more imperative, and thank God we have it.
And thank God we have you. You know, there's a little blurb on, or three words on the cover of your book from Noam Chomsky, lucid and informed. it's to the point. People get ready. The fight against a jobless economy and a citizenless democracy, Robert McChesney and John Nichols, must reading, great name. The book pops out at you if you go to a bookstore, and we thank you for spending some time. And I hope you can come back more frequently, and we can also continue to deliberate more on how the media is really disempowering us by helping us not make the right decisions to indeed democratize our society.
Well, I'd love to do that, Mimi, and thanks for having me on the show.
It's our pleasure entirely. Robert McChesney, People Get Ready, he helps us do that.
I can feel the spirit building, soft as a whisper, but loud as a roar. I can
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap. Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, This Way Out.
It's going to be a groundswell of good people coming forward and, you might say, enforcing their values on those who don't agree with them.
It is with great joy that I am here to celebrate the opening of the first International Games Athletic Olympics.
Today, we are marching as are others across America, and we shouldn't have to be.
This is not a gay disease. It is not a gay disease.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Indonesia's president tries tossing a life preserver to waterboarded queers, a Romanian marriage case divides top officials, and October's LGBT History Month flashes back to the early 80s. All that and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Michael LeBeau.
And I'm Sarah Sweeney.
With News Wrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBT communities around the world for the week ending October 22nd, 2016. The president of Indonesia has finally spoken out in defense of LGBT human rights following months of intensified verbal and physical attacks on sexual and gender minorities in the world's fourth most populous country. President Joko Widodo, known in the country as Jokowi, made his first public comments about the deteriorating situation for LGBT people this week. He said during an interview with the BBC that the police must act to protect them. There should be no discrimination against anyone. Just last month, a presidential spokesperson in the world's most populous Muslim country said that there is no room in Indonesia for the proliferation of the LGBT movement. And in his comments about protecting queer citizens this week, Jokowi himself also stressed that regarding same-gender sex, Islam does not allow it. Nevertheless, a press release from Human Rights Watch said that Jokowi's long overdue statement in support of LGBT non-discrimination is a breath of fresh air as Indonesian officials and politicians continue their abusive and ill-informed homophobic onslaught. Jokowi needs the political courage, the release added, to demonstrate that such beliefs can't and won't trump his obligation to defend the rights of all Indonesians.
Other officials in Jokowi's administration, including his education and defense ministers, have condemned the existence of sexual and gender minorities in the country. Government watchdog agencies have clamped down on LGBT-supportive social media, and just this week, Indonesian lawmakers passed a new bill that authorizes chemical castration in an effort to wipe out sex crimes. Activists have expressed fears that the new law may be used against LGBT people. Considering the rising tide against sexual and gender minorities in the country, observers aren't sure what impact, if any, Jokowi's comments will have.
Romania's president and prime minister are at odds over LGBT rights. Commenting on a case now before the nation's highest court involving the recognition of the civil marriage of a gay Romanian man and a U.S. citizen, President Klaus Iohannis, an ethnic German and a Lutheran, noted this week that he belongs to two minorities. Tolerance and acceptance of others are vital, he said. These are the values I believe in. That Romanian-American gay couple legally married in Belgium in 2010 and now lives in the United States. They launched a legal fight to get their marriage sanctioned in Romania in 2012 after the country's immigration authorities refused to recognize their union when they wanted to work there. The Constitutional Court has twice delayed making a decision in their case. The justices are now expected to rule in the coming week. The politically influential Romanian Orthodox Church strongly opposes the petition, and Prime Minister Dacian Cioloș voiced his support for the traditional family the day after the president's comments. More than 3 million people have also signed a petition circulated by a group of conservative religious groups under the banner of the Coalition for Family, demanding that civil marriage for same-gender couples be constitutionally banned. They want a legal union to be defined as only being possible between a man and a woman. Romanian law now defines civil marriage simply as between spouses.
Thousands of people marched in Paris on October 16th to demand the repeal of civil marriage equality in France, 6 months ahead of the next presidential election. Police estimated the crowd at about 24,000. The organizers, a group opposed to marriage equality called Manif pour Tous, claimed 10 times that amount. Marchers were also demanding bans on assisted fertility services for lesbian couples and surrogate mothers helping same-gender couples have babies, even though French law currently allows assisted reproduction services only to infertile heterosexual couples and bans surrogacy altogether. Organizers claim that people from all over the country took part in the march. They said they hoped the demonstration would influence presidential politics. But according to the Associated Press, none of the major candidates attended the march. France opened civil marriage to gay and lesbian couples in 2013, but conservative religious groups, led by Manif pour Tous, have maintained their indignation and opposition ever since.
Tens of thousands of people, organized primarily by groups affiliated with the Roman Catholic Church, marched against civil marriage equality last month in Mexico City. They want to stem the march of equality spurred by the nation's Supreme Court, which has ruled against several state bans on civil marriage for same-gender couples in recent years. Lesbian and gay couples can currently get married in Mexico City and 10 of the country's 31 states. However, under the nation's complicated legal system, unless bans are repealed by their state governments, individual couples must spend money and time in the court system on a case-by-case basis to get a civil marriage license. Marchers were also protesting the proposal by Mexican President Enrique Peña Nieto that civil marriage be opened nationwide to same-gender couples legislatively. But there doesn't seem to be much interest at the moment among Mexico's lawmakers to do that.
In other news, three men caused a stir in Amsterdam this week by distributing flyers calling for all religious people to unite and exterminate gays and lesbians. The leaflets remind conservative Muslims, Christians, and Jews that homosexuality is forbidden in their respective religions. The leaflets include bogus statistics that 29% of children of lesbians and gay men are sexually abused. The moral responsibility for the children, they warn, is all of ours for the coming generations. The leaflets also claim that LGBT people are more likely to suffer from mental illness and have higher suicide rates. At least 75 people have filed complaints with the police over the inflammatory handouts. One of four suspects was identified from closed-circuit video, although it was later determined that he was only with the men at the time they were distributing the flyers, but was not involved. The three other men turned themselves in on October 20th, but claimed during interrogation that they only wanted to spark a discussion. The men's identities have not been released. Authorities will only say that the trio consisted of two 29-year-olds from The Hague and a 39-year-old from Rotterdam, who said that they targeted Amsterdam because it's considered to be the country's LGBT capital. The public prosecutor's office is trying to determine whether what they did constitutes a criminal offense.
Australia's House of Representatives approved a bill this week to hold a national referendum, or plebiscite, on opening civil marriage to lesbian and gay couples. The vote was 76 to 67. But all indications point to the bill's defeat in the Senate, where government MPs are in the minority. The leading opposition Labour Party, the Greens, and a few independent MPs have united to oppose what they call a costly and divisive national vote when all public opinion polls already show overwhelming support for marriage equality. They also object to the non-binding nature of the plebiscite as proposed by Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull, under which MPs would not be required to ratify the result in a marriage equality bill to follow. The plebiscite bill now moves to the Senate. 40 senators have pledged to vote against it, two more than the 38 needed to block legislation in that chamber.
And finally, Indigenous people around the world are celebrating a breakthrough in Australia. With his recent election, Chauncey Pesh became the nation's first openly gay Aboriginal MP. He celebrated his diverse identity this week during the opening of the 13th Legislative Assembly of the Northern Territory. He also made it clear which political party made his election possible.
I am a Centralian man. I am the nation's first openly gay Indigenous parliamentarian. I am eternally proud of who I am and where I come from. I own it and wear it with pride. Madam Speaker, I am young, I am gay, I am black, a true blue Territorian. I am a proud face of the diversity and future of the great Australian Labor Party.
The 28-year-old MP was elected in August by 60% of his mostly rural constituency, despite a smear campaign about his sexuality by some of his opponents. He also called in his maiden speech for improved roadways to some of Australia's most isolated areas and made an impassioned plea for civil marriage equality.
That's News Wrap for the week ending October 22nd, 2016. Produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Sarah Sweeney.
And I'm Michael LeBeau.
These are gay and lesbian people singing out here. What's your reaction to that?
Well, I think it's terrible. I had a rock and throw it at them.
The religious right rocks on and other 80s hits later in the program. But first, how could it be LGBT History Month without at least one Rainbow Minute?
Dreaming of a Gay Olympics, coming up now on the Rainbow Minute. The concept of a gay Olympics is credited to a competitor in the 1968 Olympics named Dr. Tom Waddell. But in 1982, just weeks before the first gay Olympics was to take place in San Francisco, the United States Olympic Committee obtained a restraining order forbidding the use of the word Olympics. Although the committee had not objected to the use of the word in events like the Nebraska Rat Olympics, the Crab Cooking Olympics, or even the Nude Olympics, Waddell lost his fight at the U.S. Supreme Court. In 1987, while losing his fight with AIDS, the court even ruled that the U.S. Olympic Committee could have their legal fees of $92,000 levied against his home. By 1994, the committee had a new posture. giving the openly gay Olympic champ Greg Louganis its highest award. In his acceptance speech, Louganis dedicated the award to Tom Waddell. The Rainbow Minute is produced by Judd Proctor and Brian Burns and recorded in the studios at WRIR in Richmond, Virginia, and read by volunteers like me, Dustin Richardson.
Hi, this is Greg Louganis, and you're listening to This Way Out.
This year's U.S. presidential campaign has brought the rebirth of the phrase moral majority. The Rio Summer Olympics featured nearly 50 openly LGBT athletes. And when another World AIDS Day comes around in a few weeks, 35 million people will have died in the pandemic, and 34 million more are living with HIV. These present-day stories have their roots in the early 1980s, a period worth looking at during October's LGBT History Month. So we reached back into the This Way Out audio archives for news coverage from mid-1981 to mid-1983, when AIDS was new, the first gay games were played, and the religious right was an as yet unproven political force.
We come from the moral majority. Heed our warning when we say
it's going to be a groundswell of good people coming forward, and you might say enforcing their values on those who don't agree with them.
We are here to cleanse impurity, rid the world of vice and sin.
We're talking about well over 350, 60, 70, 80, 90 members of Congress who, if your rights and their re-election are placed on the table, don't bet on your rights.
Just like Adolf Hitler's Germany, purebred and Christian, watch out. We may win.
Although the fundamentalist movement has existed in American politics since the days of the Puritans, they call themselves the New Right. Their leaders, like the Moral Majority's Jerry Falwell, are also the spiritual leaders of conservative middle America, and they speak on matters of religion and politics with the same righteous fervor. In 1981, Falwell began a series of letters to Moral Majority members announcing a war against gays and lesbians. "Let's stop the homosexuals once and for all," he told the faithful. In September, after the Washington, D.C. City Council had thrown out the city's archaic anti-sodomy law, Falwell went to Congress, which has final legislative authority over the nation's capital, to have the D.C. law reinstated. The U.S. House of Representatives voted overwhelmingly to restore the anti-sodomy ordinance. The gay rights national lobby's Susan Green identified Falwell's primary political tool.
Fear does strange things to people, and we didn't have anything to threaten them with. The moral majority did. They were actually threatening people in Congress and saying, if you don't vote our way, we'll see that you don't get elected next time. And a lot of these people don't have spines. A lot of them just said, oh, my God, you know, I want to stay in Congress, therefore I'm going to do what these people say.
During the months after his victory, Falwell took his I Love America roadshow around the country. But in every city he visited, hundreds of gays and lesbians turned out in protest.
What are your feelings tonight?
I'm feeling wonderful. I'm feeling this is just beautiful and that people are coming together strong and loving and caring and that we're celebrating our lifestyles and that we're celebrating that we are good people.
I'm mostly shocked by the violent looks and remarks of the Falwell community walking by us. I mean, that was surprising to me. I thought that they would just accept us and walk by, you know, but they gave us remarks like faggots and get lost, and that was real ugly to me, and it verified many things, what can I say?
Hi, what do you think of the demonstration here tonight?
I think it stinks.
What do you think about Jerry Falwell mixing politics and religion so much?
He isn't mixing them. He's just telling us what the Word of God is telling us.
Isn't he telling some people how to vote, though?
Not that I'm aware of. Everybody has a choice.
So a woman should have a choice whether she wants an abortion or not?
No, I don't think she has the right to murder.
These are gay and lesbian people singing out here. What's your reaction to that?
I have a little boy, and oh, that's disgusting.
What?
You know, that is disgusting because that
Oh, I have a little boy, and I would hate for my little boy to be like that. Those are animals.
I think it's terrible to have a rock and throw it at them.
Really? That's not a very Christian attitude.
That's what they need.
August 1982.
It is with great joy that I am here to celebrate the opening of the first International Gay Athletic Olympics.
The games have been absolutely spectacular. I don't have to tell you, yesterday I cried, and I never cry. I'm one of these tough cowboys that never cry.
All the people who have been afraid to acknowledge that lesbians and gay people have been an active part of athletics throughout time, you can shout it now.
Woo!
Athletics are here.
Woo!
How long ago did you hear about the games?
About 6 months ago.
And how did you hear about them?
It was in the press, actually, in the straight press.
In the straight press? What did they have to say about it?
Oh, they just said that there were gay games in San Francisco.
Athletes came from 12 countries, 28 states, and 149 cities to participate in the Gay Athletic Games. Those nations represented were Australia, Belgium, Canada, Denmark, England, France, Holland, Ireland, New Zealand, Peru, West Germany, and the United States.
Most of us paid our own way to come here. We got assistance with track suits, a bit of sporting equipment, things like that.
The international press was also in evidence. Rolf Kunkel, a feature writer for Germany's Der Spiegel, remarked, "It really attracted our attention when the USOC asked them to drop the Olympics from the name." Just days prior to the opening of the games, the committee was informed of a court-ordered injunction preventing that organization from using the word Olympics in their name. Los Angeles ACLU Gay Rights Chapter attorney Susan McGreevy lend some insight to the court proceedings.
I'm not really concerned so much about the copyright issue as I am about the overwhelmingly poor showing of sportsmanship.
An estimated 10,000 spectators cheered the Kezar Stadium opening ceremonies, which featured marching bands, baton twirlers, square dancing, color guards, politicians, dignitaries, and the traditional parade of athletes bearing the flags of their countries. Authors Rita Mae Brown and Armistead Maupin emceed, and entertainment was provided by Meg Christian and Tina Turner. The finale of the opening ceremonies was the lighting of the Olympic torch and the release of thousands of gaily colored balloons. The torch lighting was the culmination of the work of more than 2,000 volunteer runners, walkers, and cyclists who relayed the torch across the country from the location of the Stonewall Bar in New York City some 10 weeks earlier.
It's fabulous. It looks very competitive. It's very festive is the word for it. There's a lot of athletes out here competing to enjoy themselves, which they really never had a chance to.
When I was out at the marathon, a man who ran over 26 miles came in second place, and after resting for about 10 or 15 minutes with the silver blanket that they put around the marathon runners, he turned around to the crowd and wrapped it around him. He says, "You like my dress?" And it's being able to say that after you run 26 miles.
The week had been proclaimed Gay Games Week by San Francisco Mayor Dianne Feinstein, and closing ceremonies were held on September the 5th. A tea dance took place on Kezar Stadium Field. 800 choir members sang, and Stephanie Mills performed. Of course, there was a parade of champions. Organizers said they plan to hold another Games in 1986.
This is our first Olympics in 1,500 years, and that's a long, long time. And I hope it's not 1,500 years before the next one.
Give me the ball, give me the ball, give me the ball, yeah! Give me the ball, give me the ball, give me the ball, yeah! I was always a running around down there.
May 1983.
Three Los Angeles City Council members joined a crowd of nearly 5,000 at the federal building in Westwood to demand more government funding for research into the AIDS epidemic.
We are gathered together tonight for one purpose, to fight back against AIDS, the acquired immune deficiency syndrome.
This is not a gay disease. It is not a gay disease.
I know that there are some horror stories about people with AIDS who have been disenfranchised of their basic rights. Their roommates have kicked them out. They've been served on paper plates. Their families have disowned them.
Support the community. Help us deal with the panic, because people are panicking.
If we withdraw from one another and excoriate one another because of our guilt and our fear, we'll only add joy to the heart of every right-wing, Bible-thumping homophobe in America.
Tonight, we are marching as are others across America, and we shouldn't have to be.
When I asked my doctor what my mortality would be, he didn't have an answer.
Tonight, we are pleading for our lives and the future lives of Americans, and we should not have to be.
It's very frightening to think. More often than not, I've read that the average lifespan is 2 years after diagnosis, and I hate to think I'll lose my brother at 24.
You don't have to be Jewish to care about someone dying from Tay-Sachs disease, and you don't have to be black to care about someone dying from sickle cell anemia. And you don't have to be gay to care about someone dying from AIDS. All it takes is a little human decency.
I was diagnosed with AIDS last December. The worst part of having this disease, and I think this is true for most other AIDS patients, is not the physical hassles. They're bad. But the worst part is the sense of isolation and the incredible loneliness and the times of indescribable hopelessness in combating this disease. But as I look out tonight and in talking to people before, all I felt was a sense of faith and hope and a lot of love coming from all you people. And right now, I don't feel any sense of isolation or loneliness, and I don't feel any sense of hopelessness. And it's this kind of concern, the kind that's brought you people here tonight, that makes me able to stand here and say, I know I'm going to win over this disease.
Rest of the world between 1981 and 83, Thousands demonstrated against bathhouse raids in Toronto. Paris saw its first Pride March, and the European Court of Human Rights issued its first ruling against the criminalization of homosexuality. U.S. President Ronald Reagan finally mentioned AIDS in public in 1985. Living in wartime, singer-songwriter and AIDS activist Michael Callan succumbed to the disease in 1983. And in the 2016 presidential race, Jerry Falwell Jr. has endorsed Donald Trump. Thanks for discovering This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. This week, Michael LeBeau, Sarah Sweeney, and Dustin Richardson, produced by Judd Proctor and Brian Burns, contributed program material, with thanks, as always, to Steve Pride. The reporters in the early 80s history feature included David Hunt, Timothy Sturton, Debbie Fidler, Joan Klein, and Josie Cotoggio. Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Yavanna Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our listener supporters, who all make this program possible. Email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and the entire This Way Out family, I'm Greg Gordon. We all thank you for listening online at thiswayout.org and on BCFM Bristol, England, Radio Phoenix, Phoenix, Arizona, WHUS Storrs, Connecticut, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. It may sound weird, it may sound utopian, but an unconditional basic income is what many people have been advocating for years. You would not have to work to get this income. Everyone would be entitled to it, and in some scenarios, it's enough to live on. So what explains the appeal to many on the left of the basic income? Why have some conservative and libertarian thinkers embraced the idea? Would the economy collapse because most people would stop working? And to what extent would the adoption of an unconditional basic income facilitate or fuel a transition away from capitalism? Eric Olin Wright is a leading proponent of a basic income and a prominent radical scholar. He is a professor of sociology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and his books include Understanding Class, Alternatives to Capitalism, and Envisioning Real Utopias. When Eric Olin Wright joined me in studio, I asked him when the notion of a basic income first caught his attention.
Well, it first caught my attention in the mid-1980s in the context of a gathering of intellectual sort of Marxist philosophers, sociology, economists, a group that met every year called the Analytical Marxism Group. One of the members of that, two of the members of that group were Philippe Van Parijs, a Belgian philosopher, sociologist, political scientist type, and Robert van der Veen from the Netherlands. There are two members of this group along with me and Jerry Cohen and a bunch of other people. And Philippe and Robert van der Veen wrote a paper called The Capitalist Road to Communism. Quite a famous piece, published in the journal Theory and Society. I think published, maybe wrong, 1985 probably is the, maybe 86, right around mid-1980s. That was my first introduction to the idea of unconditional basic income. And in the context of the publication of that paper, I wrote a commentary for that journal, you know, which the commentary basically took the point why socialism is necessary, as a necessary condition for a basic income. That's what really got me engaged in this. And since then, I've written a number of pieces and been continually in discussions around basic income and its ramifications.
So in titling their paper, The Capitalist Road to Communism, were they suggesting then that something could be done within the framework of capitalism to move society in a communist, in a socialist direction?
Well, they specifically, it's of course meant to be a very provocative title, a little bit of a tease, because it shouldn't be taken too literally. By communism, in the context of the rhetoric of that paper, they meant a society governed by the two each according to need, from each according to ability formula. By socialism, they meant an economy in which the means of production were collectively owned or state-owned. And capitalism, they meant what everybody means by capitalism. So what they were basically arguing is that with an unconditional basic income that would provide in a serious way for the needs of everybody, people could just opt out of capitalism. So each person could choose whether to live in the capitalist world or the communist world. And then if most people liked communism over capitalism, the society would drift in that direction. It wasn't so much that it was a literal road to the whole society being communism. It was a road to people being able to choose to live in a world governed by the distribution principle to each according to need. And then they would contribute whatever they wanted according to their ability.
So what would an unconditional basic income, what would it basically entail?
All right. Well, the first thing to note is that the idea of unconditional basic income comes in a variety of flavors. And depending upon which flavor, it means different things. For some people, an unconditional basic income is really a bare minimum survival income. You know, to use it a kind of metaphor, you don't starve if you have a basic income. Most progressives who embrace the idea think of it as a more generous idea, that a true unconditional basic income enables you to live at a culturally acceptable, decent standard of living, which would include, therefore, enough income to have recreation, but a kind of no-frills version. So you can perfectly comfortably get by with it, but if you really want to live a more extravagant lifestyle, then you have to earn additional income one way or another. So that's how I like to think of it. Certainly for the purposes that I defend an unconditional basic income, it's above a survival level.
And who, in your idea of the basic income, who provides this income and how often?
Well, income means it's a flow. So it's more of a practical than a principled question of whether it's provided, so to speak, on a weekly or a monthly basis. Some versions give you an annual lump sum. I think that's probably not prudent just because of people's incapacity to budget well. So, you know, you think of it as a paycheck. So paychecks typically come on biweekly or monthly basis. It would be a flow of income along those lines. It's provided by the state, and it's paid for through taxation. Everybody gets it. Everybody. Bill Gates gets an unconditional basic income.
It doesn't depend on whether you work or any other criterion.
Right. Crucially, it doesn't depend upon how much money, how rich you are. The unconditionality has both a moral component, you don't have to be a good person to get it, and it has an economic component. It's not means tested. Now, of course, the taxes needed to pay for an unconditional basic income for Bill Gates are going to go up by many orders of magnitude more than the basic income he receives. So Bill Gates would be a net contributor. And there's lots of details about how that works. One should think of it in the same way we think of unconditional, or used to think perhaps of unconditional basic education. Everybody gets it. Some people are net contributors, that is, their taxes go up in order to pay for public education by more than they receive in public education. But that's seen as okay because it's a public good and it makes for a better society if everybody gets a basic education. Well, basic income has a bit of that character. Everybody benefits from it, even if you're a net contributor, because it creates a different kind of society, a society in which everybody has enough to live a morally decent or culturally acceptable standard of living.
So what impact would an unconditional basic income have on people's ability and inclination, really, to take a job, to go into the labor market and work for money?
Well, let me first clarify one other detail about the design, and that is who gets it. So we said it's unconditional on means testing or on virtue. There is still the question of whether, for example, it's a citizen's income or a resident's income, that is, anybody who lives in a country, anyone under the jurisdiction of that state should get it. And if it's a resident's income, does it include undocumented workers? Now, to some extent, these are practical questions rather than principled questions. I mean, practical in the political sense. It's pretty hard to imagine an unconditional basic income ever passing, you know, even in pretty progressive places, that would include illegal residents. Everybody agrees that tourists shouldn't get it, you know. So somebody's coming to your country on a tourist visa, they don't, while they're there, get an unconditional basic income. I think on principle, it should go to everybody who's in the economy, in the labor market, in the labor force. That the question of how do you deal with the illegal migrants is a separate question, which needs resolution. We need ways of dealing with that. But that the moral principle of unconditional basic income is precisely that anybody who is on your territory participating in the economic life of your society should unconditionally have their basic needs met. In the most fundamental sense, I think an unconditional basic income should be for everybody in the world. I mean, I think you should have a global basic income.
Yeah.
And it should be globally redistributed. Well, that's certainly not on as a practical political move.
Eric Olin Wright joins us in studio. He is professor of sociology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and a leading radical thinker. I'm C.S., and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. And we are talking today about unconditional basic income, which Eric has written a lot about and thought a lot about. So Yeah, back to this question of jobs and the necessity of having a job. So if the basic income, the unconditional basic income, provides you with a kind of culturally acceptable, no-frills existence, then is the whole idea that people would no longer need to go out onto the labor market?
The idea is that you don't need to go onto the labor market to get your basic necessities. So in the United States, roughly speaking, and, you know, vary from place to place because of cost of living, but think of an unconditional basic income as being in the $12,000 to $15,000 a year range, roughly speaking. Which would mean if two adults live together, they have a household income of $30,000. You'd have to think through the details about children. You know, do you get a partial basic income? How do you do it? Again, those are important details. We can put those to the side. So just take a couple. $30,000 in most places in the United States, you can live okay. But most people probably want more income than $30,000. So there'll be at least some reason why many, I think most people, will want to gain additional earnings. With an unconditional basic income, as soon as you earn additional income, you start paying taxes on the additional. There's no... The unconditional basic income isn't taxed. It'd be kind of directly. If all you live on is the basic income, you don't pay taxes, income taxes on that. But you start paying taxes on any earnings above your basic income. The tax rates will be higher. You have to figure out exactly where the cut point is, where you become a net contributor rather than a net beneficiary. But there's no disincentive to work. That is, you're not. The first $10,000 you earn above your basic income is not going to be taxed at 80%. You know, probably have a 15 or 20% tax rate on the first $10,000 you earn above the basic income. So the first thing to note is there's not a disincentive to work. And it's only people whose life plans are consistent with $15,000 or $30,000 if they're in a couple, whose life plans are consistent with that level of earnings, who will say, that's all I want. Now, there will be people, certainly people, for whom that's true.
But if they think that way, that is a disincentive to work. I mean, a lot of people are worried that so many people will take themselves out of the labor market that the economy might even collapse.
So just to be kind of technically precise, a disincentive means you're punished if you work. This would mean
gotcha.
A lack of an incentive to work for them, right? So there's no... They don't feel any incentive to work because they feel no need to work. But there's no disincentive to work. With means-tested anti-poverty programs, there's an actual disincentive to work because you lose your benefits if you work.
Right.
Okay, well, there's no disincentive then to work. Yeah, so a basic income is an unworkable plan if it's the case that the large majority of people really have as their deepest longings to be couch potatoes. So, you know, if the human spirit, contrary to what many of us believe, is really profoundly lazy in the sense that we don't care about creativity, we don't care about making a contribution to our world and leaving our stamp with our in some way or other, we really just want to watch soap operas, right? So if that is what we are at our essence, you give people $15,000, everybody stops working, the system collapses. Well, I'm being sarcastic, you know. This is a caricature. There will be some people, though, that will absolutely, you know, live a life of leisurely indulgence. Philippe von Paris, is one of his earliest and terrific pieces on this, is called Should Surfers Be Fed? Should Surfers Be Fed? And it's basically raising the standard big objection to basic income, that it will mean that people who work hard and generate the income that gets taxed by the basic income will be subsidizing beach bums.
But you could certainly, maybe with a basic income, you could be a beach bum, but you could also be productive in a way that's not profitable to you, right? That doesn't involve working for money. So, for example, you talk about, you've written about caregiving labor, and the fact is that many caregivers are not compensated at all. Well, this will allow them to do work, and, you know, it's certainly not couch potato work, so they'll do work, that kind of work. They won't have a job for money, for pay, And so how does that work in the context of basic income? And to what extent is that a positive thing in your eyes?
Of course, it's an absolutely positive thing. There's a huge amount of socially productive labor that contributes to human flourishing, both of the person performing the labor and to other people in their lives. So there's lots of activities of that sort which would expand under an unconditional basic income. It gives people, in a sense, the possibility of saying no to capitalist employment and saying yes to all the other socially productive, interesting things, constructive things people can do. So caregiving would be one sort of obvious example, both for elder care and for children and disabled care. But so would the arts. An unconditional basic income might increase the number of bad poets in the society because it would enable more people to say, I want to try to be a poet, and not all of them will be good poets, so to speak. But it enables people to engage in the arts in a way that they can't if they have to be preoccupied with earning a living. Unconditional basic income also has a very interesting effect with respect to agriculture. So agricultural subsidies in the world in which we live now are justified on the grounds that they enable small farmers to exist. The rhetoric around the defense always has the image of the small family farm. But overwhelmingly, agricultural subsidies, both here and in Europe, so this isn't just an American pathology, everywhere goes to agribusiness, goes to big, wealthy investors in agriculture, not to family farms. So imagine the following. Just get rid of all agricultural subsidies, zero subsidies targeted to agriculture, but give people unconditional basic incomes. Suddenly, small family farms become quite viable because the farmer then is only producing for discretionary income. They're not producing their core income. They're just producing their discretionary income, which means that they can devote full time to farming if they want. And farms that were shaky and marginal before, because the family had to also engage in paid labor in the city, you know, a typical kind of problem for small farmers, suddenly become viable. As a prediction, I think an unconditional basic income will increase the number of people engaged in agriculture. It will provide a kind of grounding, not to mix my metaphors, for urban agriculture in some places, because it means that people can engage in a more serious and intensive form of community gardening and urban agriculture because they don't have to generate their full livelihood out of it. And it would lead to an absolute expansion and enrichment of the arts.
What about the situation of paid workers, so people who do go out and get jobs? What do you think an unconditional basic income would do to their situation?
Well, it's a little unclear. You know, there are ambiguities. On the one hand, really crappy work that people hate doing, which also in the current world is often badly paid work. One possibility is such work would become more expensive. That is, employers offering the job of picking strawberries. You know, I'm using that as a metaphor. I don't know enough about the technology of picking strawberries to know if this is still true. But it used to be the kind of example of backbreaking labor that had very high rates of occupational injury because of the necessity of bending over so much. It'd be very tough to get people to do strawberry picking. So strawberry picking would become more expensive. On the other hand, there's lots of jobs that people really love. And if they had $15,000 guaranteed, they might be willing to do it for less.
Interesting.
I think with an unconditional basic income, the natural thing to do is to get rid of all minimum wage laws. There's no need for them. You know, so if you really want to do something for $5 an hour because it's great fun, it's meaningful, and that's what the employer is able to pay, go for it if you have the $15,000. Now, some people, particularly some of my comrades on the left, get queasy about basic income when they think, maybe this is a subsidy for low wages. It just makes it easier for the scoundrels to pay little. On the other hand, since the exit option for workers is always there, they can say no. The fact that it ends up being a subsidy for low wages means that those low-wage jobs are attractive for other reasons. And I don't think that the kind of the moral dilemma around subsidizing low-wage labor in the sense of it being exploitative, I don't think it has the same bite under conditions where workers really have the exit option. They can say no to it.
I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Eric Olin Wright joins me. He is Vilas Distinguished Professor of Sociology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and he's author of many books, including Understanding Class, Envisioning Real Utopias, and Alternatives to Capitalism, Proposals for a Democratic Economy with Robin Hanel. And I and Eric want you to know that many of Eric's books are available for free online. We've put a link on our webpage at kpfa.org. Just go to kpfa.org/programs and click on Against the Grain, and you'll find a link to Eric's website where you'll find links to, PDF links to, many of his publications. So essentially what you're saying is that workers have more power, they have greater leverage in relation to employers under a system with unconditional basic income. And is that part of the reason, well, how big a part of the reason that you support unconditional basic income is this, that there are unequal power relations in capitalist society and that a goal, an important goal of a movement for social justice ought to be to adjust and transform those power relations?
Yes, certainly. That, if you really play out the logic, that's probably the most fundamental issue for me, is its effect on power relations. But I think one needs to think of it in the following more, perhaps slightly more nuanced way. One can think of the redress of the imbalance of power of capitalism either in terms of the collective power of workers via their organization. That's classically how we do it. We argue workers are individually weak, but collectively they can be quite strong. And labor unions have been the principal form of such collective power of workers. And in sometimes in places, political parties that are either explicitly linked to the labor movement or at least implicitly linked to the labor movement, collective power. Unconditional basic income has a particularly strong effect on the individual power of workers, that is, their ability to say no, which is a individual ability. You can walk away from a deal. That gives you power. It increases, therefore, their individual autonomy and capacity to do things. That has a second-order effect on their collective capacity. But it still has a potential positive effect on their collective capacity. It could conceivably weaken their collective capacity because they don't care about it as much. You know, if individuals can say no, why do we need a union? Unions have traditionally been very hostile to unconditional basic income. It's not part of the traditional union view. What unions want is to strengthen their negotiating power with employers in order to get a better wage bargain, among other things, with capitalist employers.
Is there a scenario in which you see unconditional basic income actually improving or augmenting the strength of unions?
Well, it could if there are grounds for solidarity that can be sustained, because you can think of unconditional basic income as an unconditional strike fund, too. It means workers could collectively refuse to work because they want improved working conditions or whatever, and the union doesn't have to have a strike fund because every worker has an unconditional basic income. Well, an unconditional basic strike fund is certainly something which would increase the negotiating power of unions, but only if workers also joined and voted for and backed unions. And I think on that score, it's ambiguous. I wouldn't want to sell basic income to unions on the grounds, look, support this because it's going to increase the power of unions. It might, but it could, in fact, undercut the power of unions.
Well, yeah, let's talk about political activity and the potential for progressive or radical political activity in a nation that has unconditional basic income. So what impact do you think such an income might have on, you know, political activity, community organizing, social movements?
So the most obvious effect would be to provide a massive basic political income, you know, for activism income. It means that people can be community activists in all sorts of ways without having to, apply to nonprofits, to foundations, to find activist groups that happen to have angel donors. You know, they basically have an unconditional basic income that would support community activism. What I think one can say with kind of a simple, straightforward prediction is that locally oriented problem-solving activism in a grassroots sense, that would increase. Some of that will have quite progressive characters, but it would also mean that people involved in faith-based, church-oriented good works would increase. So exactly how that plays out politically, I think, is another ambiguity. So that's for sure. Now, whether it also contributes to a more coherent progressive politics, not just local activism doing good stuff, that, I think, doesn't follow one way or another from basic income. If there are social forces engaged actively in the solidarity work and the political work around those broader movements for change, then a basic income makes their job easier. If those don't exist, I don't think a basic income triggers their existence.
Eric Olin Wright, Vilas Distinguished Professor of Sociology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. We are talking today about unconditional basic income, which is an income unconditionally paid to all on an individual basis without means testing or a work requirement. It's a minimum income guarantee with no strings attached. We'll take a short break and speak more with Eric. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Eric Olin Wright is my guest. He teaches sociology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He is a leading radical thinker. We're so happy to have him join us in studio. His books include Classes, American Society, How It Really Works, co-authored with Joel Rogers, and Deepening Democracy, co-authored with Archon Fung. And much of his academic work has focused on reconstructing the Marxist tradition of social theory and research to make it more relevant to contemporary concerns. So unconditional basic income is not just a proposal of the left or the far left. In fact, some people on the right, some conservatives, some libertarians have advocated a basic income. So I have to ask you about their perspectives. Now, Charles Murray, best known for co-authoring the very controversial book, The Bell Curve, actually advocates giving $10,000 per year tax-free to every adult over 21, or at least he did in a book and in several writings he's written over the years. What do you think of his proposal?
Well, the key to his proposal is what you eliminate to fund it. Now, every basic income does replace some programs. If you have the kind of basic income that I support, which would be modestly generous, you would get rid of unemployment insurance. You don't need unemployment insurance. You might also get rid of Social Security, retirement pensions, publicly funded pensions. There's no particular reason why you need a publicly funded pension if everybody has a basic income throughout their whole life. So you save quite a lot by getting rid of anti-poverty transfers and so on. The general view of progressives is you get rid of nearly all cash transfer programs, but not everything else. You still need universal health insurance. We don't even have that. You need universal public education. You need all sorts of other publicly provided services that contribute to human flourishing. And basic income just deals with one piece of a person's standard of living, that part of your standard of living that comes from the income, the money you have at your disposal. Charles Murray wants to get rid of almost everything else. I was in a discussion with him at one point in which he made the following claim, that his first best option was to have no basic income and nothing else. You know, he wants to get rid of all state funds for egalitarian social support, risk reduction. He thinks there should be no public insurance and virtually no public services. And his belief is that private charity would deal with the deserving poor. Anybody who is suffering for no fault of their own will be taken care of by charity, in his view. And the incentive for charity is squeezed out when the government does it. That's his perspective. So get rid of everything would be his first choice. But then he says, well, he knows that's not politically possible. So the second best is get rid of everything and then put back a survival income, a bare survival income. But then people still have to buy health insurance. They have to buy all the other services that previously were provided by states. So that's a really nasty proposal. It's using basic income as a cover for just dismantling the role of the state to deal with the harms of a capitalist economy.
What about the argument that a basic income would minimize the opportunities for political rent-seeking and opportunism, because it would stop being the case that, you know, those who make the strongest political case or who are best at manipulating the system would get the most out of the system, would get the most back from the government?
Well, it's an optimistic view that giving everybody a basic income would automatically undercut the power of corporations to get special deals for themselves. I see no obvious reason why the tax loopholes that corporations get for special privileges disappear just because you have a basic income. I think what one might believe, there may be good reason to, is the political context in which a universal, unconditional, generous basic income was enacted would also be a context in which corporate welfare would be eliminated as one of the ways of helping to pay for it. But there's nothing intrinsic in an unconditional basic income that eliminates rent seeking as such.
I want to return to something you said earlier. So if increasing the collective power of labor versus capital is one of your primary goals in advocating for an unconditional basic income, and if you're not sure whether the collective strength, not the individual strength, but the collective strength of workers will be augmented by an unconditional basic income, because, you know, workers might have higher individual leverage over employers but not necessarily want to join unions or strengthen unions, then I'm not sure what accounts for your continued support for the income.
Okay, so let's go through some steps to get to this point. The reason I strongly support rules of the game that increase the collective power of labor is because it's part of a bigger package of wanting to transform capitalism, and in particular wanting to transform capitalism in a way that points beyond capitalism. The rhetoric I use these days when I talk about this is that if you're opposed to capitalism, there's a variety of strategic visions you can have. You can have a vision of smashing capitalism. That's the ruptural revolutionary tradition. You can have a vision of taming capitalism. That's the social democratic idea of neutralizing its harms. You can have a vision of escaping capitalism, the sort of hippie in the woods solution. Or you can have a vision of eroding capitalism by building alternatives in the spaces where that's possible and then engaged in struggles to expand those spaces. Build the future you want in the places where you can in the present and expand them through struggle. Now, the eroding capitalism requires changes in the rules of the game as well. Unconditional basic income is attractive because it's a change in the rules of the game about how people gain access to livelihood. It's a different kind of capitalism with an unconditional basic income than without it. But it unleashes the potential for people to engage in the process of building other kinds of economic systems inside of capitalism. They have the freedom to build a different world in the present. It would increase what's often called the social and solidarity economy, would increase all sorts of cooperative enterprises. It would accelerate, and this is might seem a little odd thing for a leftist to say, it would accelerate automation and the elimination of paid work in certain sectors because it becomes expensive since people don't want to do it. Well, that's actually a good thing. It's a good thing to get rid of work that people don't want to do if the only reason they do them is because they don't have an exit option. So you give them an exit option, you automate this stuff, but the people whose time and effort is liberated by that automation then can, if social forces are encouraging them in various ways, build alternatives. So that seems to me, in the long term, if we want to ask, what would it take to move beyond capitalism? If you don't think that a revolutionary rupture is any longer a plausible scenario, which I don't think that there's a plausible scenario in which you can seize power and smash the power of the capitalist class in some ruptural moment. I just think that's implausible, both because I don't see a scenario to get to the point where you could attempt it, but the attempt itself would blow up in your face and produce a world other than the world that we want. So if smashing capitalism is just not plausible, then eroding capitalism is the only prospect for its fundamental transformation. And basic income underwrites that dynamic, potentially. But like everything, I think, it has this contradictory quality. And thus, it would become a crucial problem to be solved. How can we reconstruct the collective agency of people to act politically? It becomes less important for them to act against employers at the point of production. That ceases to be the main site at which struggle is needed. But the struggle in the society over the rules of the game, over the state, is every bit as important, if only to defend the basic income and to make it a generous as opposed to a miserable one. You know, that requires collective action. And that is a problem. That is a problem. And it's a problem for which I don't have any magic wand solutions. But I think a capitalism with a generous basic income is a better terrain upon which to work on that problem than the capitalism we have today.
I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm speaking with Eric Olin Wright. He teaches sociology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and he's a leading thinker on the issue of unconditional basic income, which again would be an income unconditionally paid to all individuals, all residents of a certain nation, paid by the state, no means testing, no work requirement, no, you know, determination that your total wealth is below a certain figure. And it would, at least in some perspectives, according to some perspectives, including Eric's, it would provide for a basic, culturally acceptable, no-frills existence. Well, I guess it wouldn't be a basic income if it were means tested, but why not means testing? Why not just say, look, if you have less money than X amount of money, we'll give you this basic income unconditionally, you know, having only one condition, that you really need the money, and rich people will just leave alone. We won't give them any income. We won't give them a check every week or month.
Well, that's a bit like saying if your income is above a certain level, your kids should pay tuition for elementary school. There's something about the universalizing of the right. Every kid goes free, but the rich people pay more taxes. Indeed, the rich people are paying for the schooling, but in a form that is not assigning it to the point of entry into schooling. There's a variety of reasons to make it unconditional. One is, if it's unconditional, there's no line of demarcation between who gets it and who doesn't. if you create a line of demarcation, the political tendency will be for it to drift downwards. It fractures solidarity between recipients and contributors. And furthermore, it misinforms people because it makes it seem like if you're above that threshold, you're not benefiting from the basic income. The basic income is insurance for everybody. It means that you can make choices in your life knowing that you've got that basic income. You can take time off. You can take a sabbatical, in a sense, if you're willing to cut back on your expenses. The other thing which is very important about this is that an unconditional basic income is incredibly efficient administratively. You don't have to worry about people hiding income. You don't have to worry about scams. You know, there'll be some fraud people who will try to collect two basic incomes by having phony identifications or something. Of course, there'll be any system's going to have ways for people to get around the rules. But it's really simple. Everybody gets the check. Everybody gets the flow of income. The deadweight overhead costs of running an unconditional basic income are really low. Means testing adds a level of monitoring. You have to check on everybody. Are you or are you not eligible? Some people say, well, we should have it be unconditional, except that everybody has to do some kind of contribution to the society just to avoid the parasite problem. But again, that creates an enormously difficult monitoring problem. What counts as a contribution? How are you going to observe it? How do you avoid phony contributions, et cetera, et cetera? So one of the attractions of the unconditionality is its simplicity. Let me just add one thing here in terms of the rhetoric around unconditional basic income. There are a variety of different defenses of it, reasons why people say, ooh, that's a great idea. Philippe von Paris, who I consider the deepest thinker about the philosophical foundations for a basic income, his position is what one might call a left libertarian position. It's or an egalitarian liberal position. What he argues is that unconditional basic income takes really seriously the value of freedom, which most people in Western democratic capitalist societies believe is a good thing, freedom, individual freedom. But it says the only way that we can have real freedom for all is if everybody has a basic income. So it's an egalitarian distribution of resources in order to create an egalitarian distribution of freedom. It really just says for freedom to be meaningful, you have to be able to make choices. And above all, you have to be able to say no to things that are harmful to you. And that's what an unconditional basic income does. It enables people to say no to bad employment. It enables people to say no to bad marriages. Women in particular, under the current conditions, the capacity to exit a marriage increases by virtue of the guarantee of the resources independently of any obligations. So Real Freedom for All, that's the title of his famous book on the topic, I think is the foundational justification, and that also justifies its unconditionality.
Let's talk about its political feasibility. I mean, do you see this scheme, this system of unconditional basic income being feasible in, well, I should say this nation, but any nation in the near future?
Well, in the United States, where unconditional basic health isn't even feasible in the near future, you know, when we got close to being able to possibly have a breakthrough, the patchwork system that was the only one that could pass through the political system still left huge holes in the insurance system. So certainly the United States is not a fertile ground for any progressive breakthrough. There are other places in the world where this is being actively discussed, thought about. In Finland, it's part of the political agenda. In Switzerland, there's going to be a referendum on unconditional basic income, I believe, in 2017. The rates that's being discussed in those countries is in the order of magnitude of 1,000 euros a month. So that's, you know, in the $12,000, $13,000 range. So, yes, it's on the agenda. It's on the agenda in the United States, for that matter, in surprising ways. I gave a talk in San Francisco, and when I mentioned basic income in the context of the broader themes of my talk, the audience broke into spontaneous applause. Now, I can tell you, as an experienced academic who's given many talks in many places, that's practically the only time I can remember in the middle of a talk spontaneous cheering and applause for invoking some abstract idea. So clearly something is bubbling up. Now, partially what's bubbling up is the idea that the trajectory of employment in highly productive, technologically advanced capitalist economies, the trajectory looks pretty grim for providing not just employment, but decent employment for the large majority of the population. There's lots of data to support that the increasing polarization and inequality that we observe on the earnings side of the equation is not just on the nature of the flows of income, but on the character of the jobs available in the economy. And, you know, there are dire predictions about automation basically destroying all jobs. Those kinds of apocalyptic views, I think, are overstated. But it is certainly true when people think about the future of work and paid employment that the trajectory in the future does not look promising.
So kind of the inability of advanced capitalist nations to generate a sufficient number of jobs that pay reasonably well, I mean, that inability ought to incline policymakers, in your opinion, toward this idea of a basic income?
So it's one of the fixes that could get onto the agenda because of those conditions, yes. So generally speaking, my perspective on what are the conditions under which radical reforms that open up new progressive possibilities, what are the conditions in which they can occur and be stably instituted? One of the conditions, I think, which makes such breakthroughs stable is if they also solve a problem for elites. That it's not just that your capacity to mobilize forces the state to make a concession that's good for the masses of people. If that's all that's going on, then as soon as that mobilization dies back, as soon as people relax or as soon as the political moment passes, then those reforms are vulnerable to reversal. So the conditions under which I think a radical reform has the possibility of becoming stabilized is if it also solves a problem from the point of view of dominant classes and groups rather than just serves the interests of popular forces. And basic income, I think, has that character. It solves a problem of the inability to generate good employment and therefore an inability to generate the necessary earnings for people to buy the stuff that capitalists make, right? So there's a kind of Keynesian face to the unconditional basic income.
And as a way of summing up, I know we've touched on these rationales, but I know you wanted to emphasize kind of three central rationales or defenses for unconditional basic income on the left, on the progressive left.
So the simplest and most straightforward that I think draws people most directly to unconditional basic income as an idea is that it solves a pressing problem, poverty in the midst of plenty. You know, we're an advanced capitalist society, incredibly productive, producing huge amounts of wealth, and yet we have poor people. Well, unconditional basic income provides this simple mechanism for simply saying enough is enough. Let's set the basic income above the poverty line. Everybody has enough at that basic level. So anti-poverty and the injustice of having poor people in a rich society, I think, is probably the motivation or the rationale that draws most progressives towards basic income. The second defense of basic income is the defense that Philippe von Paris has emphasized, real freedom for all. Now, the real freedom for all argument applies even if you've solved the poverty problem just by giving lots of means tested and special programs and Medicaid and food stamps, so nobody is really destitute. They still don't have the kind of autonomy that would come from simple unconditional basic grant. Real freedom for all says everybody should be free to make choices on without the constraint of having to look for work. So that you could think of as the left libertarian or the liberal egalitarian, that's another way of thinking about it, defense. So anti-poverty, real freedom for all. And the third argument, which is the one that I've emphasized, I indeed endorse all three arguments, but the third argument, which I emphasize, is that unconditional basic income opens a space for a new kind of dynamic in a capitalist market economy which makes it possible, but not inevitable, but possible for people to build non-capitalist relations of production, to build within the sort of fabric of the existing society an alternative society with more emancipatory spaces. And then whether or not those spaces are filled by interesting and progressive, productive activities, that depends upon how people respond. And the collective action and community solidarities, grassroots activism, all these things will determine the extent to which those spaces are filled and then what obstacles those spaces face and how we transcend those barriers. So my third then rationale is not the static one, that it gives people more choice right now, nor the anti-poverty one. It reduces suffering in a world where that's not necessary any longer, but a dynamic argument that it sets in motion a different kind of social dynamic that pushes against the boundaries of capitalism in new and hopefully productive ways.
Eric Olin Wright, Vilas Distinguished Professor of Sociology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And his books include Understanding Class, Envisioning Real Utopias, and Alternatives to Capitalism, Proposals for a Democratic Economy with Robin Hanel. And again, many of his books are freely available online via his website, and we've put a link to his website on ours at kpfa.org. Just go to kpfa.org/programs and click on Against the Grain, and you'll see the link with today's program. Eric, thank you so much for joining me.
My pleasure.
And that interview first aired on April 5th. And this is CS suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, as Albert Einstein once said, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources and links, and a way to sign up for our podcast. And check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio. Thank you.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.